Good evening. I'd like to welcome you to the April 3rd, 2018 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call of members.
Mr. Klein?
Here.
Ms. Corman?
Present.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
I'm here.
Mr. Morey has asked to be excused. Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Ms. Black?
Here.
Ms. Champion?
Here.
Ms. Dawson?
Here.
Mr. Granison?
Here.
Mr. John has also asked to be excused. Ms. Kellis?
Sorry.
Here. Ms. Kellis? Ms. Robertson?
Here.
12 members present.
We will do a little bit of reordering tonight so that some staff can leave before 9 o'clock. But first, so Fernando, where's Fernando? I'm talking about you, wherever he is. All right. We will start with privilege of the floor for the public. I would first ask everybody to turn your cell phones off or to vibrate, and we will go ahead. The rules for speaking on the privilege of the floor. I agree to a 3-minute time limit. I agree not to raise my voice. I agree not to use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language, or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of the peace. I agree not to speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about the job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, I agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor. Transferring time to another person is not permitted. I agree that if I cause a disruption and am asked to leave, I will leave the chambers. I've got John Spence and then Tom Shelley. John Spence?
John Spence, I'm the Executive Director of the Community Arts Partnership. Community Arts Partnership is the Arts Council for Tompkins County. We've been visiting for 7 years, and we have, in that time, administered a little over $4 million worth of grants in support of the arts. I'd like to read a letter from CAP Board to the legislature.
John, you get to start
just
over.
Slides in, snaps in. Okay, you know who I am. Letter from the Community Arts Partnership Board. The Community Arts Partnership of Tompkins County would first like to express its appreciation to the county legislature and to the Strategic Tourism Planning Board for their significant and ongoing support of the arts locally. We are blessed to live in a community where so many people are passionate and willing to step forward in support of the arts. The CAP Board of Directors certainly appreciates the current interest in increasing funding for the arts and agree that the need is there. We look forward to having a constructive discussion about meeting those needs within the STPB's 2019 budget process. As an organization that advocates for and administers grant programs in support of the arts for the state of New York, Tompkins County Private Foundation, CAP relies on an established process for budgeting, evaluating grant applications, and distributing funds. Our mandate necessitates working with funders to make sure that funding recommendations are approved within a clearly understood set of guidelines and therefore are sustainable year to year. As advocates for the arts and for our community, we look forward to working on strengthening the support of the arts with the STBB and the legislature going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Tom Shelley, and then I'm having trouble with this name. Frank Proto.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tom Shelley. I live at 118 East Court Street, right across the street here. I've been an Ithaca resident for almost 43 years. I'm on the Environmental Management Council of Tompkins County. I'm also on the newly formed Parks and Recreation and Natural Areas Commission of the City of Ithaca. I'm also the chairman of the Board of Sustainable Tompkins and participate in many other organizational efforts in Ithaca and Tompkins County. So I have a pretty good background in environmental issues. The plastic bag issue is in front of us, and I urge the legislature to support the state, ultimately whatever will become of the state law, supporting the ban of single-use plastic bags and converting to a 10-cent fee for paper bags and or promoting reusable bags more substantially than has been done in the past. I took some time today to look through a couple of life cycle cost analysis of different kinds of carrying bags from shopping venues. And Mike Ziegler is right in the fact that it costs a lot more money to transport heavyweight paper than lightweight plastic. And if you look at the life cycle cost analysis, it actually indicates that plastic bags actually have a lower energy impact than paper bags do. So they're better in that regard, if you want to put better on it. But paper bags also have a very high environmental costs, especially in terms of terrestrial acidification and severe contamination that is generated by the manufacture of all different kinds of paper, even craft paper. So there's a balance there that you have to look at when you're deciding what to do with a shopping bag. The other issue, of course, which I think is of much more consequence, is that almost all plastic bags in particular are made from oil and or gas, mostly gas, and they use a lot of energy in terms of fossil fuel consumption. We are a county that has banned fracking. We are also trying to reduce our methane consumption by going to electrical firing of heating and so forth in residences and businesses. And so I think it's time that we back off from gas altogether. And not only plastic bags, but other types of plastic need to be looked at more carefully and possibly eliminated from our environment as well. Some supermarkets now have plastic-free aisles or whatever. So we have some work ahead of us, but I think it's the right way to go. And thank you very much for your attention to this program. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Tom. Frank Proto, former legislator on this body for more than 25 years. Welcome, Frank.
Don't start the clock yet. I have to lower this, thanks to John's, if I can. I'll talk like this, if that's okay. Good evening. I'm here this evening to urge the legislature with the Tourism Board to recognize the importance of those arts and cultural groups that help build this successful county program, and to not just restore funds to them, but also to secure their future. Mary Kane, at the time, Trocham and I sat on the floor of the Community School of Music and Arts in the late 1980s, when I was a member of this legislature, with a county charge to write the plan and revamp the then Tompkins County Arts Council. Today you know it as the STPB. Recognizing that every community could not sustain individualized programs, we just identified the city of Ithaca as the focal point. Our hope was to support and strengthen those programs that became this group's foundation. Eventually, the county incorporated the community celebrations budget line, some of you may remember that, Martha, to permit smaller municipal countywide groups to participate. While recognizing that priorities change, I don't want to think that the intention is to cause harm to those very groups that laid the foundation for this successful endeavor. Rather, I'd encourage the legislature to charge itself to review and return to the original intent and provide these entities with the support as was once intended. And, of course, I'd be happy to meet with any one of you to do a history lesson on this. You got the Reader's Digest version tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Always
not
great.
Bad.
Very good. That's a first.
Martha, do I get another 3 minutes?
No.
I'm just going to hand this to the next person. Who's next?
The next person is Peggy Coleman and then Kelly Cartmill. Thank you.
I am also not quite up to the stand height. I am Peggy Coleman. Thank you, John. I am the VP of Tourism and Community Relations for the Tompkins County Chamber of Commerce, also known as the Director of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, or CVB. And I am here to just share some thoughts as you're contemplating the funding for ACOD. And I really appreciate that many of us are underfunded. There are really great, hardworking administrators and executive directors who are always advocating for additional funding to support their organizations and the good work that they do. And I also feel that no matter how well-intended, the campaign to adjust the ACOD funding allocations, it's just unfortunate that the information that's been shared publicly is incomplete and therefore skewed. Despite the fact that the STPB has publicly discussed that they were incorrect with advocates at a recent STPB board meeting, what funded ACOD organizations and others are relying on in launching this campaign is at best incomplete information, and public opinion is being swayed by hearing only one part of the story. As you make a decision about how to move forward, I urge you to rely on the tourism staff in the county tourism program and the planning department, the STPB board, who volunteer countless hours for a very complete and extensive process, and the budget committee members to receive the correct information. I really think it's important that we look at the fact that the ACOD grant is a competitive grant. And in the same way, if someone was to apply for a grant from the USDA or NISCA, the New York State Council on the Arts, and were not happy with the amount they were receiving, it would be inappropriate to lobby the governor or a state legislator, so I just hope you'll keep in mind the process and support the work of the STPB.
Thank you, Peggy. Kelly Cartmill and then Scott Wiggins.
At least you put it to my height. If I can get it in here, okay. Hi, my name is Kelly Cartmill, and I am the current chair of the Strategic Tourism Planning Board. As chair of the STPB, I believe the work we do is important, and the countless hours we spend out of our already busy lives to dedicate to our county's tourism program irreplaceable. It is unfortunate that I need to come before you today and defend the work we do. We are an appointed board of educated experts in our respective fields within the tourism arena. This campaign represents a complete disregard for the process by which we follow when awarding grants and program funding for the tourism tax from the tourism tax revenues. This resolution asks you to just award money to one grant category, ACOD grant category. There is no discussion or consideration for any other programs or grant categories. Currently, we have other grant categories with much higher requests for funds than money to give, much the same as the ACOD grant category, some even higher. I would ask you, what makes ACOD more important or deserving of these funds? There are a number of other potential uses of this money that need to be considered
including other grant categories such as capital grants or new tourism grants, areas of the strategic plan such as outdoor recreation, agriculinary tourism, projects such as the Tompkins County Center, History and Culture Center for History and Culture, that's going to be a name, a tough one, or wayfinding, or quite simply the CVB, the leading demand generator to create additional room tax dollars in Tompkins County. You have been told by this campaign that the arts and culture organizations in Tompkins County had their funding cut and need this money to be raised back to appropriate levels. This is simply not true. Overall funding to the arts and culture organizations has increased, not decreased. In fact, arts and culture organizations have received more funding than any other sector through all the programs and grants made possible by the tourism tax revenues. The STPB Budget Committee and P&E Committee jointly met to discuss the surplus in question and the proper process and procedure for the reallocation of these funds. We are carefully considering all the grant requests and program requests along with the priorities of the strategic plan that we follow. There is a much bigger picture here to consider than one grant category for 10 grantees. We are a board with defined seat representation to take into consideration all areas of tourism. We are considered the experts in this field, and we are charged by you, the county legislature, to set policy for tourism and provide overall strategic direction for the use of the room tax funds. Several grants, including ACOD grants, are competitive grant programs with clear evaluation criteria to ensure the investments are targeted and have a better chance of meeting program objectives. We have 18 room tax funded programs and over 80 grantees annually. I feel it is irresponsible for us not to consider all these entities when we decide on the reallocation of any surplus tax revenue. As chair of this dedicated and knowledgeable board, I can only hope you won't undermine the work we do and instead support us and the process we follow. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Scott Wiggins and then Stephen Stull. And if anybody who's come in since we started wants to speak, you can find another blue sheet in the back.
Good afternoon, and thank you. My name is Scott Wiggins. I am a passionate supporter of the arts. My family owns La Tourelle Hotel. As a hotelier, we collect the room tax and pay that room tax. I have been on the Strategic Tourism Planning Board first for 12 years and then was off the board and recently rejoined the board again for 2018. I'm here to urge you to support the efforts of the Strategic Tourism Planning Board and the challenges we have every day in balancing the needs of our grant programs with available resources. As we begin planning for our 2019 budget, we've already begun looking at what reserves might be there over our normal reserve fund and started the process of how we might fairly share those reserves with programs and grant recipients throughout the STP, the programs that are supported by room tax funds. I personally don't believe it's appropriate for a small group of recipients to come directly to the county legislature to ask for additional funding without that being that opportunity being given to all of the grant recipients and programs. I think Ithaca is an amazing community, and what we do with our room tax funds, particularly to support the arts and culture, I'm extremely proud and inspired by. I just ask this legislature to respect the efforts on behalf of the Strategic Tourism Planning Board, our processes, and the hard work that we put into making these grant recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott. Stephen Stull and then David Kraskow.
Hi, I'm Steve Stull. I've lived in the town of Lansing since 1986. I'm here to speak in support of funding for the arts in the county. I've worked with many of the arts organizations here in town and sing with opera companies and orchestras across the region. I'm also executive director of Triphammer Arts and produce music and dance events at the CRS Barn Studio on our organic farm on Triphammer Road. We personally supply rehearsal space to many local arts organizations, including the Hangar Theater, Opera Ithaca, the Kitchen Theater, and individual artists. We are currently storing Ithaca Shakespeare's entire costume collection at no charge. Triphammer Arts received a modest community celebration grant in 2017 and have applied for another in 2018. Previously, I served as a member of the Community Arts Partnership Board for 6 years and am friends with several of the members of the Strategic Tourism Planning Board. I applaud the hard work of the STPB and the county legislature's support for the arts community. I believe that the ACOD funding should be granted as proposed by the STPB board This funding process is extremely complicated, and I believe that the process is widely misunderstood. The passion that has arisen recently is merely an indication of how strongly residents feel about the arts community here. I searched through the minutes of the STPB, the legislature, and public IRS 990 documents, mostly from 2016, in an effort to discover how the $2.7 million of room tax money was divided and how arts funding had dropped as a percentage of that. After a bit of research, one major factor in lower arts funding seems to be the decision to fund the Tompkins County Area Development for 5 years with funds from the room tax money, starting in 2013. Looking into the financials, I was surprised at the level of the salaries of the TCAD officers. The TCAD president has a higher salary than the Tompkins County administrator, and the two vice presidents of that organization make significantly more than the executive directors of most of the arts organizations in town. TCAD also has substantially higher net assets listed than most the ACOD group, especially in cash and savings. The 2020 strategic tourism plan lists a policy to, quote, use reserves for tourism, which may be how some of this controversy has arisen. It also lists a policy to rebalance the 60% marketing, 40% product development ratio with a new formula established no later than 2014. It also has a policy of new initiatives to reach beyond currently funded organizations, since many local organizations are not currently eligible for significant funding. Perhaps a rebalancing of the marketing and program percentages, as well as reducing some of the TCAD funding, might allow the STPB to grant funding beyond the small group of current anchor institutions. It would also be great to see more funding reach beyond the city of Ithaca, which, according to the 2014 room tax spending report, received 65% of grants and 68% of funding, while 1% went to 12 other municipalities combined, 3% if you include community celebrations. Thank you, and I urge you to continue to support the arts in the county.
Thank you, Steve. David Krasko and then Ann Klingensmith.
Dave Krasko here. I live on the south side of Ithaca. And I am a new or pretty new person in this world of funding and the county. I joined the Cayuga Chamber Orchestra Board because I love classical music. And I'm on a learning curve right now is what I would say. I loved hearing the things that I did and the fact that John mentioned the next budget, 2019, that's my speed. I'm into the slow and steady deliberative process. And I'm hoping that the other things that I have to say will be on the philosophical level that's appropriate. I don't think anybody has said it yet. I am grateful for the positive outcome of the legislative process. The arts and democratic discourse go hand in hand and are among the antidotes to uncivil tendencies in our current cultural drift. Generally, funding for the arts is steady or going up. Generally, concern for the arts is present and vigorous. Cuts and restorations from 2010 to 2018 looked like they were fluid, reasonable responses to fund availability, made with good faith and a lot of collegial work, interpreting, prioritizing, and defining, executing the multiple mandates of the tourism funds and public funds generally. All participants recognize that the arts community contributes significantly to civic health and the many outcomes of a thriving cultural environment. It's important to our community's moral and civic and economic health. We have a bona fide commitment to these things, a future of artistic production, artistic merit, and creative work opportunities for those who do this in the community. I love all the projects, arts and non-arts, that taxes fund. I think taxes are an investment in our civil society, and that's the direction I would like to see it go. It's not a burden for me, and I'm sure that everybody has their own reaction to the phrase taxes, but I see it as an investment. We should support the major arts organizations. But, you know, it's like we talked about over the Seder table or any table at home. You know, you can say, well, maybe now the room taxes, we're getting 10% towards the major organizations. Parenthetically, I'd like to see more small startup organizations get money too, but it's not part of the mandate, it looks like. Well, should it be 10%? Should it be 15%? 15% is $300,000 maybe, right? Maybe it's supposed to be a little more. But it's that level of abstract argument or discussion that I'd like to see. Is it 10%? Is it 15%? And so on. I have to close with gratitude for the increased funding for the Arts and Cultural Organization Development Grants Program. Tompkins County Tourist Program. I feel gratitude for the legislator who listens to us and acts, and the Strategic Tourism Planning Board, and all vocal advocates for government that invests in the things that make for a more civil society.
Thank you, David. Ann Klingensmith, and then Dan Weed.
Hi, my name's Ann Klingensmith. I live in Danby, and I'm a new member of the Environmental Management Council.
Go a little closer to the mic.
I'm here to again urge you to support the bag ban in whatever form you feel it's appropriate. Since I spoke here last month, I've spent a lot of hours on the web, and the web is awash in articles about plastics, microplastics. I was actually a little bit stunned at some of the reading that I did. We've been using plastics for enough years now, and we all know that they break down into microparticles. They don't go away, and they're literally everywhere. We eat them, we drink them, we breathe them in. And it's a giant experiment. I mean, nobody really knows exactly. You know, they're not inert chemical things. They're part of the biological system now. And I think that, you know, we've unleashed something that we may regret. So I would actually urge that the bag ban be the first step, and think of it as the first step towards something that would rid the world of more plastic. And I think we can start things like that right here in Tompkins County. So thanks for your support.
Thank you, Ann. Dan Weed, and then Flossie Martell-Glennon.
Good evening. My name is Dan Weed. I'm a Newfield resident, president of the board for Alcohol Drug Council in Tompkins County. First, let me thank the legislature for your strength of character, the power of your diversity, and the passion that you've exhibited towards combating epidemic, the national epidemic of substance abuse, not just in our nation, but directly here in Tompkins County. One thing I'd like to share this evening is there's a chasm in our society. The chasm between what is said and what is done. We've recently had $3 billion dedicated nationwide to combat the opioid epidemic. We have an amazing, marvelous executive director at the Alcohol and Drug Council that has taken a vision and shared with focus and clarity of purpose to address the opioid epidemic in Tompkins County. Lots of money, that's what's said. A vision, focus, purpose, and energy, that's what's done. The national epidemic isn't somewhere located remotely in another state. It's right here in Tompkins County. We are embarking on a project for 24-hour open access that is going to transform an individual's recovery from business hours 9 to 5 Monday through Friday to 24/7 when they're ready to reach their recovery. Every person in this room has been touched by this, and I want to encourage the legislature to please continue to use your character, your diversity, your passion to continue to support this project. Stay involved, because the future of the success and the health of our community rests with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for your work on their board. Flossie Martell-Glennon. And Callie Brunell.
Hi, my name is Flossie Martell-Glennon, and I am here to speak on plastic bags. 80% of the ocean on this earth is now polluted with plastic floating on its surface. There is an estimated 8 million metric tons of plastic waste that enters our oceans each year, and the numbers are going up by the second. Think about it this way. It's all a cycle. We use the plastic bags. They go into dumps and into the earth and ocean. It photodegrades, which means they break down into tiny pieces that never disappear. The animals in the ocean eat the plastic. People have pulled handfuls of plastic out of birds' bodies. Other animals pass on the chemicals which poison the animals. We kill these creatures for food and poison ourselves. Then the cycle starts again. The animals in the ocean are dying because of the plastic we pollute. Some of the animals that are being killed are sea turtles, seals, sea lions, seabirds, fish, whales, dolphins, and many others. These animals also get caught in netting, plastic bags, bottles, etc. We must do something now. The planet we call home is dying around us because of our choices. We can choose to change, and we can stop using plastic bags here in Tompkins County. We have the ability to make that choice and lead this change. I hope you will support the New York State ban on plastic bags. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Flossie. Kelly Brunell, followed by Margot Brin.
When I grow up, think, what will the world look like? Currently, over 1,270,500,000,000 plastic bags have been created just this year. We can't wait any longer. We must act now. Plastic bags have become a cheap, easy way to carry our stuff around. But is it worth it? No, it's not. This is a serious problem, and the answer is in our grasp. We must move toward to reusable bags and walk away from single-use plastics. 12 minutes. 12 minutes is approximately the amount of time a plastic bag is used for. Then it is thrown away. Where is away? There is no away. When a plastic bag gets thrown out, it travels to the dump, and over time it photodegrades, which is horrible for the environment. Change must happen now, or else our world as we know it will be gone. Which is why we must take this essential step to ban plastic bags in New York. Let me remind you that this is the only home we know.
Thank you very much, Kelly. Margot Brin and Marie McCray.
Well, since my then 5-year-old granddaughter Callie called me very upset when she heard about the animals dying and getting sick from ingesting the plastic, I've been her ally in trying to end the widespread use of plastics in our environment, and hoping that this legislature will support the proposed ban on plastics. Paper bags are terrible in both production and transportation. They are very bad for the environment, too. They don't pose the same post-use litter, pollution, animal harm, nightmare on recycling facilities. I actually called our recyclers, and they said, yes, they're often. It's a big problem, and they have to actually have somebody there constantly weeding out the plastic bags. And even though our waterways are not the major contributors to the ocean plastic, nevertheless, the EPA estimates 4 to 12 metric tons of plastic enter our own local waterways annually, which pose a threat to our wildlife and the condition of the waters and the condition of the fish that we eat. Since talking last month, I investigated how some communities have handled it. And the way they've handled it in the proposed legislation is to put a small fee on paper bags. And in the communities that have done it, and for example, in D.C., they have 80% of the customers now bring their own bags. In L.A., there's a 94% reduction in paper, as well as no use of plastic. Education alone isn't sufficient. On a statewide level, it will reduce the use of plastic by 5%. In Ithaca, it's probably higher. But it's not sufficient. And I really want to appeal to the legislature to support this initiative, allow New York State to be a leader in environmental protection. Let's begin to turn the tide of this polluting the environment.
Thank you, Margo. Marie McCray and then Mike Miller.
Thank you. Marie McCray from Dryden. And I, too, am here to urge you to support a state ban on plastic bags. We all know that all of the bags that we carry around have some problem in their manufacture, in their disposal. I consider that a ban on single-use plastic bags is a start. We need to start somewhere. As this young woman here said,
There is no way.
Marie, did you click the thing off? Hold it close to you again.
Hello.
Did we get that one?
We are microphone challenged.
Okay, we got it. I urge you to do this, to support the statewide ban. And then, when we get that, let's work on other containers. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie. Mike Miller, you'll help me, correct me on that. And then Brian Eden, and that's the last person signed up. If anybody else would like to speak, just pick up a blue sheet in the back.
Mike. Hi. Is this on now?
Yes.
My name is Mike Mellor. I'm on the STBB board. I sent you guys a letter a couple days ago, which I sort of took the tactics being used on this subject personally. I wasn't going to say anything tonight, but I was asked when I came in to expand on that a little bit. Although, since I've been here, I've learned that I'm also like to ban the bags as well. So. I happen to chair three of the other committees that grant funding to various people that qualify to apply for them. And unfortunately for me, as I mentioned, I took some of this personally. I shouldn't, of course, but I did. And I feel that I just want to let you know that chairing these committees, this is not going to happen. I won't let it influence me. But I kind of feel like some of these programs that are getting the ACOD funding maybe don't deserve the funding from the other programs they're getting, because it's been implied that they only get funding from ACOD, and that's just not the case. So that's not going to happen, because I'm a huge proponent of the arts as well. But I just wanted you guys to know that there's some tearing apart of the process and how some of us feel about the tactics being used. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. And Brian Eden is the last speaker.
I'm Brian Eden, chair of the Environmental Management Council. In 2017, Governor Cuomo appointed a task force to study the issue of plastic bags. The task force, which was a bipartisan group with Tom O'Mara and the chair, the CEO of the Food Industry Alliance, identified six major problems that affected the environment and municipal government impacts from plastic bag use. Approximately 60% of the public comments received on the report recommended a plastic bag ban with a 10% or 10-cent fee on paper bags. The EMC supported this majority recommendation simply for politically expedient reasons. We hope that once the problems were identified, those resistant behavioral change would also compromise. This nuanced approach was not well received by those who lobbied for no change at all. The EMC readily acknowledges that all of the studied options for retail carryout bags have negative implications for our carbon footprint. However, there are other justifications on which to base our decision to reject plastic bags, such as negative environmental and public health impacts. Our preferred solution then, as it is now, supports the use of recycled fabrics that have been manufactured without the use of toxic dyes, to produce long-term reusable bags. We do not support recycled non-woven polypropylene plastic bags that are only somewhat delayed on their way to the landfill or to be stripped, discarded on the landscape. We also support a program to make such inexpensive bags accessible to all community residents at low or no cost. Now I return to the theme that I introduced at a previous meeting, the throwaway society. We now purchase 500% more clothing than we did in the 1980s. Some of this is lightly worn and is frequently donated to make more room for their replacements in the closet. When you donate used clothing in the neighborhood boxes, only 10% is resold at low-cost Goodwill-type organizations or donated to needy families. The other 90% ends up in their secondary textiles market. Some are cut out for non-clothing uses. Approximately 13 million tons are annually disposed at a landfill, representing 7% of the disposed waste in those landfills. We need to find better uses for unwanted textiles, and there are ample quantities for production of reusable bags. This recommendation only barely addresses the magnitude of the waste problem. There are plastic cups and straws, excess packaging materials such as styrofoam, etc. Earth Day 2018, merely 2 weeks away, is themed a world without plastics. Serious problems with plastic bags have been identified. We and future generations will be forced to live with the consequences of these problems if certain residents remain unwilling to make a slight change in their behavior. We have learned to separate our plastic and glass recyclables from trash. This has reduced the cost of the county's waste disposal. With minimal effort, we can further reduce our waste that are transported to Ontario County where they are not wanted. So think about our planet, our families, when you reject the reusable bag option and double down in support of plastic bags.
Thank you, Brian. James Ork. We should have like a prize for who just hits that 3-minute mark. I think Brian gets that tonight. James Orcutt and then David Squires.
I'm going to have a hard time keeping being close to him. Actually, I'm here. I'm Dr. James Orcutt. I've lived in Ithaca for 74 years, and I love this place. And I'm new to the arts of Ithaca. You know, I was a dentist for many, many years, and we worked in much smaller spaces. It's interesting, though. I came here expecting to do the rah, 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 let's really support the arts and go for it. And I found out that we're all on the same page, but we're on different paragraphs. And it's interesting because I listen to some people say, well, you want more money for this, you want more money for that. I think what we should all do before everybody gets upset is review the Tompkins County Strategic Tourism Plan. I read it for the first time today. I thought it was fascinating. You know, they have some really, really good goals there. You know, they want whatever arts organization it is to be a memorable experience. They want to create demand. They want to create a new, unique place. They want to improve the quality of life, not only for other people, but for residents here. Isn't that amazing? They want to improve the economic climate. And lastly, they want to encourage and develop strong programs. Well, I think that, being a new guy in the arts, I found out how difficult it is to get money. And I really admire what you do here because you give us money for operations. Everybody else, if you apply for a grant, you have to have a purpose. And you have to figure out what their purpose is. And one of the worst jobs in the world is applying for any grant. They're awful. It's just agonizing. And trust me, you know, I'm used to little tiny details, but that's nothing compared to a grant application. So I think that we should all sit down and say, what's working here and how can we encourage this to get better? And I'm from the Cayuga Chamber Orchestra, and I think we've done a marvelous thing, even though our funds were cut in 2015, and we've gradually gone up and we've asked for a lot more. And you should always ask for more. The worst you could do is say we're not going to give it to you. But it's really, really important that we do something to make this a better community. And I think that the Cayuga Chamber Orchestra not only has provided role models for musicians and for young people and for older people, we've connected the two colleges together, and we also have started a youth orchestra, which is remarkable that we can do this. And we're bringing people in from all over the state for our youth orchestra. And if you haven't been, please come. And if you need tickets for the CCO, please call me. I'll get you there. I may not get you back, but I'll get you there. But I think that before we argue with one another over what's going on, I think we should take a look at what we're really supposed to be doing. And until we do that, we're going to have some problems. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Orcutt. Now, this must be old home night or something? David Squires, for anybody who doesn't know, was...
Well, I couldn't help myself when I heard you were talking about...
Wait a minute. Let me introduce you, David. The county finance director, who was proud to say that he was able to retire unindicted after all these years. Hello, David.
And I'll have you know that I never had the privilege of sitting in these comfortable seats.
Oh, you might not have retired.
I mean, I should be a workers' comp. Sitting on that benches in the courthouse for 18 years. I'm here to support the arts. As you know, I'm here representing my wife, who wanted to find out what was going on because she's very protective of the arts. My observation is, though, the room tax, I can remember back in when I started in 1992, the room tax was $400,000 or $500,000. Now it's over $2 million a year. And it's always been a political situation where you have the tension between events and venues and what puts heads in beds versus what enhances the community, like people coming into town to go to restaurants and attending an event. They're all worthy justifications for giving room tax money. My observation is the amount that's gone to the arts organizations has not grown commensurate with the growth in the rooms that are collecting the tax. And I think that Frank, I agree with Frank's statement. He was there before me with this issue. But the other thing I wanted to bring up about the room tax is having also been responsible for the collection of the room tax, I got to say, should be on the guard for slippage in that revenue with the Airbnb situation. And also our experience is that I may be cynical about this, but just because you have a new hotel with a brand name doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get the room tax, the correct room tax from them. The problem you have with the room tax is the county collects it. New York State collects their sales tax. And if you tell the New York State that, hey, this vendor is not paying their room tax, they don't care. They won't even help you. So what I'm suggesting is you should be on guard against that. And one idea I have is because I know that my colleague, Mr. Snyder, is going to get a new position in his office, and I would recommend that he assign some time to go to these new venues coming online and compare their sales tax returns to the room tax returns, because we had experiences in my tenure where vendors would file room tax reports without any checks attached, so they would skate penalties, but we'd spend a lot of time trying to collect. And a lot of these new hotels, they have the franchise name, but are they the operator? I know there are some less than scrupulous operators who take the room tax and use it to fund their cash flow of their operation. And the only way you can prevent that is by more intense scrutiny of these people. And the finance department, for as long as I was there, got $25,000 a year to administer the room tax. I think finally in my last couple of years, we might have got a slight inflation boost, so we might have gotten like $28,000 upon leaving the county while the room tax grew. But you need even more vigilance now because you have these three new properties coming online. In my tenure, the only new properties really were the Hilton Garden Inn and the Country Inn and Suites. But I strongly recommend that you pay attention to this. Compare those venues' sales tax to their room tax reports.
Thank you very much, David. No pressure on you, Rick, but David, he's been taking notes. So thank you very much. I've got Susan Stafford and then Thomas Mann.
Good evening. Thank you so much for hearing us all speak this evening.
I'm the budget chair for STPB, and I have been a 10-year volunteer steward of whatever room tax we collect, regardless of whatever practices may be in place before that process. We work very hard. We are a volunteer group that has been charged with the stewardship of the room tax dollars by our legislature, and we honor and respect that charge. As the chair of the budget committee, we work very hard with new hotels coming online, with changes in Airbnb rules, and with the money that we're given to disseminate among a number of organizations, all worthy of consideration, all important to a community to keep it holistically exciting and fun to both live in and visit. And I urge you to continue with your support and encouragement of our stewardship to do the right thing and offer these opportunities when we have them. It's very rare that we would ever have a surplus, but when we have this opportunity, that we look at all the avenues that could enrich our community rather than just arbitrarily assign it to something. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susan. And seriously, we're going to have a reunion tonight. Thomas Mann is next. Tommy is the husband of Pam McAsee, another former legislator. Welcome, Tommy. How are you?
So I can't go anywhere without being a political husband.
Sorry, yeah. Or at least you can't come here without it.
Anyway, this plastic bags, they got to go. I'm here to support the arts, and because that's the a member of the board of directors of the Grassroots Festival, and I was former past president of Ithaca Community Recovery, and both those organizations are basically run by volunteers. And the Grassroots Festival, biggest event in Tompkins County, and then Ithaca Community Recovery, kind of 700 people go through those doors every week. So, and some of those people from out of town, too. So, you know, anything that is going to hold back or isn't going to provide enough money for, especially not-for-profit arts organizations, because those are really the soul of the city, of the county. These people are, and most of them are run by people who don't make a lot of money or they're volunteers, and it makes them feel good about being here. And people want to come here. They want to come to Ithaca. They retire here. They move here. They come here for the weekends. And one of the reasons is there's so many good arts opportunities to take part in the county. I just noticed that coming online, well, been online, last year there were two more festivals at Stewart Park. It was the Reggae Fest and the Ex-Ambassadors. And they were both huge successes. They're going to do it again. They're going to expand a little bit. And, you know, there's a huge arts community here, a lot of musicians. And I just talked to a young man who wants to move here for that reason. And so, you know, they got to flourish. And so I'm supporting the arts, but I'm also supporting the not-for-profits like Porch Fest that's become a huge success. Around. I'd like to see it done all over the city, really. But, you know, anything that I don't exactly understand, you know, the ins and outs of how the room tax is going to be used, but I want to make sure that I know it's hard because I've been out there fighting for pieces of the pie and that not-for-profits have to go for. And it's really hard for them to get money for bricks and mortar, which means their staff, basically, through grants. So anything the county can do, I urge you to do it. And everything you have been doing, I appreciate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tommy. And please give Pam our best.
Thank you. She's doing better.
Wonderful. That's good. Is there anybody else who'd like to speak? Thank you all very, very much. I'm going to go to George McGonigal from the City of Ithaca. And then we'll go through the consent agenda that will send a few people away, I think. I mean, I didn't mean that. I mean, I know everybody's totally fascinated by everything we do, and you want to stay for all of it, but just in case you have other commitments. So welcome, George. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'll just give you a brief update about what we're doing in the city. We have our Common Council meeting tomorrow evening. One of the things we'll be voting on is extending a planned unit development overlay district to a larger part of the city. The downtown area of College Town, the corridor of West State Street heading west, and much of the West End on both sides of the flood control channel. Another thing that we are studying is a proposed Parks Master Plan, which includes a lot of significant changes, some of which affect the county, if it's put together. It's got a long ways to go. A third thing I'd like to mention is the city was awarded a grant from the Bloomberg Philanthropies organization for $100,000. We're going to use that to study the possibility of a safer consumption space for the opioid crisis. It will not involve implementing anything. It's a study, and it will be administered by Southern Tier AIDS, Southern Tier AIDS program in the city. And I specifically asked the mayor about county involvement in this process. And, of course, the city is very cognizant of the county's role, and we're hoping for a collaborative undertaking. The last thing I'd like to mention is, in some ways, the most disturbing news we've had in the city recently, and that is that the emerald ash borer has arrived. It's been found in two spots in the city, one on West Hill, another on King Street, and this is serious trouble. 14-15% of the mature trees in Stewart Park and in the golf course are all ash trees. We are going to aggressively fight this in the city, at least on the city-owned trees. And we're going to start this spring with an injection method of killing the emerald ash borers. It's going to be expensive, but it's actually going to be cheaper than doing nothing, because if you do nothing, the trees die, and you've got to take them down. And a lot of ash trees are brittle, and branches can fall as they die, and they can knock people in the head, and that's not a good thing. So this is a challenge we face, and I have to say that our city forester has seen this coming for a number of years, and so we're ready to meet the challenge. That's all I have.
Terrific. Thanks very much, George. Any questions for George? Amanda.
I'm just wondering if you could give us an update on the West End, the State Street Bridge, bike lane change. Like, where is that in the process? What's happening? And also the Brindley Street, I've noticed that there something is starting there. I don't know, maybe an update or timeline.
I really don't want to talk about that. The Brindley Street Bridge was initially a one-year project. They've decided, and I think rightfully so, that there's a big chance of the bridge support construction settling because the soils are so wet down there. So they're actually going to do it over a two-year span. Mm-hmm. They're going to build the approach and let that set for a year. And then they're going to build the bridge. So the bridge will probably be built, knock on wood, next year. The West State Street project has been approved so that the four lanes on Route 79 will be squeezed down to three, and the center lane will basically be a left turn lane, half of which is going out of town and half of which is coming in on to Tagannock Boulevard. I don't think every single little thing has been finalized. There's talk about putting an island in there, which some of us disagree with. So I don't think that's going to happen this year, this construction year, but I suspect next year. It's all been approved.
Mike?
I was just wondering about the Emerald Ash Borer. Have you talked to our county planning department at all?
I have not.
I know Scott, we have county forests, obviously. We're actually going to go and cut, I think, some of those trees in our forest just because better to reclaim them now before they die. So, you know, I just think he knows probably a lot about it, and I would recommend talking to Scott about it. Just maybe he'll be able to help you with the city with some ideas.
Right.
Just a thought.
I mean, the ash trees are a major part of the northeastern forests. It's also hemlocks are in jeopardy.
Yeah, the woolly delegates were up in those parts.
Right.
Anna?
Yeah, I thought that presentation that Scott gave, he gave it at PDEC, and it was really good. I mean, I know there's one difference that our forests are, you know, we're looking at them to harvest, and we can do that. The city, the ones in the city, you know, are not, you know, outside of the city in places where people don't go necessarily. So it's a bit harder because they're there for parks and recreation purposes. But I know that they've brought in some experts. So just adding to what he said, that might be helpful.
I'll mention that to the city forester.
Anything else for George? George, you've talked to us about Charter Communications and Spectrum TV, and I wanted to mention, did you get the email that I first sent to Annie? I asked Annie to send a message to Common Council today.
Oh, I haven't even looked at my emails today.
Okay, so the owner of WENY, one of the co-owners, the ABC affiliate in Elmira, is going to be here tomorrow to meet with me, and I invited council and legislators, if anybody wanted to join me, to talk about the situation with their affiliate. So that's 3:30 tomorrow right here if you have nothing else to do.
No, I'd like to do that, actually.
Okay. All right, great.
Especially if it's raining.
Okay.
Thank you.
I can't promise, but join us tomorrow. Thanks very much. Okay, thanks. Thank you very much, George. All right, I want to ask first, is Fernando still here? Fernando? Okay. All right. Let's go through the consent agenda first in case there's anybody waiting for something on there. And then I'm going to toss a coin about which is, like, going to be a faster discussion, bags or tourism. So maybe we'll do bags and then we'll do tourism. What are you pointing to, Deborah?
The floor, legislators.
We'll do that after, I'm afraid. We've really got people who came to hear us act. So I think it's, unless people can be really, really quick.
I have one that's really, really quick.
Okay, go. All right, Debs, thank you.
So thank you to everyone who came and spoke tonight. And for the emails that you sent, because sometimes it seems like our residents aren't very civically engaged, and it's heartening to see that they actually are. It's been a busy, busy couple of weeks for our legislature, what with reading and answering all your emails. And although it's been busy for us, it's been a very difficult time for members of a couple of our volunteer advisory boards, and particularly for members of our Environmental Management Council. So these remarks are for those volunteers. Most legislators value your commitment and expertise. I'm very grateful for the time you give us and the dedication you bring to your duties as advisory board members. I appreciate your adherence to your proper processes, and I respect your recommendations. It doesn't mean I'm almost going to agree with you, but I respect you as subject matter experts who give of your time freely to make Tompkins County a better place to live. When a legislator disagrees with an advisory board recommendation, he or she can express that disagreement through a number of avenues. However, professional and basic human courtesy demand that that disagreement be confined to issues. Discussing the basis for disagreement on an issue is fair comment and adult behavior. Ad hominem attacks on people's diligence and competence are not. Our advisory board members care. They know their stuff. They work hard for free, and they don't deserve abuse from a paid elected official. And I, for one, am really sorry that not everyone on this legislature seems to appreciate that. So thank you for that opportunity, Martha.
Okay. Thank you, Deborah. Anybody else with something quick? Okay. So let's do the consent agenda. First, are there any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? Okay, consent agenda. Let me know if you have something to pull off. Resolution A, awarding of construction bid for Ludlowville Stream Bank Stabilization Project and budget reappropriation of 2016 grant funding to the 2018 budget. That's ID 7708. Resolution B, acceptance of grant from the Park Foundation for the HeatSmart Tompkins 3 program of Solar Tompkins, ID 7716. And appointments to the Cougar Lake Watershed Intermunicipal Organization. Okay, I guess I'll do that under my chair's report. All right, well, I was half there. This is my little piece of the chair's report. Cougar Lake Watershed Intermunicipal Organization, Deborah Dawson, delegate, Ann Corman, alternate. These aren't chairs. All right. And to the Environmental Management Council, Don Smith, and to the Strategic Tourism Planning Board, Susan Stafford. Is there a motion for the consent agenda? Moved by Anna, seconded by Amanda. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. So let us go to plastic bags. Is there anything? Let me see. I know we've got... You know what? We've got the alcohol council folks waiting. Well, let's go to... Sorry, what?
There's so many.
Let's try it this way. Resolution D, Shauna Black, do you want to take that one?
Yes. I would like to move the resolution that's included in your red folders as adopted by committee. ID number 7723, supporting the development of a regional open access medically supervised withdrawal detox stabilization center in Tompkins County.
Seconded by Leslin. Any discussion? See, I knew that would be quick. All right. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? Great. That's unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Leslin.
Not a big discussion, but I just want to thank Angela Sullivan and board member and the rest of the Tompkins County Alcohol and Drug Council for moving this forward because it is very much needed. So thank you.
Yes. And since this was going to be part of my report, I'm splitting up my report all over the place here, but thank you very much for hosting us along with the Mental Health Department. On Friday, thank you, Sharon, for Senator Schumer's visit. Yes? Senator Schumer was here on Friday and announced, as Dan Weed mentioned, the $3 billion in new funding in the omnibus, federal omnibus spending bill that was passed a week and a half ago. But the senator was here especially to urge that the funding be actually moved along, that it not just sit there on a shelf, but that we really have to get this money to work. And we were delighted to be able to offer him a location with an agency and a county department that are working full speed ahead towards actually putting those kinds of funds to work with significant grant funding from the state already and other grants pending, and now we hope a federal grant pending. This is something that's truly, really, really important in our community. So thank you. Thank you both organizations for hosting us on Friday, and we will do everything we can do to help. Okay, thanks.
Which one? The election?
Okay, Resolution C should be similarly expeditious. Shauna.
Yes, Resolution C, Doc ID 7707, Award of Contract Electronic Health Records and Practice Management System, Mental Health and Public Health Departments.
Moved by Shauna. Seconded by Anna. Any discussion? All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous as well. Thank you very much. All right, Anna, let us go to resolution. Which one? D?
E.
E.
Plastic bag?
Let's do plastic bags first, yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to bring everybody's attention. Well, first, I guess I'd like to move it.
Yes. Okay, read the title.
I just wanted to. Yeah, no. I'll move it first. Resolution in support of a statewide ban on single-use carry-out retail bags. I so move.
Seconded by Deborah. Document 7712. Okay, it's packet page 13. Go ahead. You want
to? I wanted to put forward an amendment, and that is in your green folders, and that is with a couple edits. I mean, in your red folders. Woo! Y'all, I didn't sleep writing that article in the middle of the night, so bear with me. But in your red folders, there is an amendment. So first, I'd like to put that on the floor.
Okay, seconded by, I guess it's an, you're moving to amend, and this didn't come out of committee. So you're moving to substitute, I mean, moving to substitute this resolution. Substitute. Seconded by Deborah. Okay.
So something that I wanted to bring forward, because I know that there is a lot of discussion of the environmental impacts of paper versus plastic.
And what is 1 second, just for the public, these are basically grammatical and clarification language. There's nothing substantive in the resolution.
Right.
In the change.
And there may be some discussion about further wordsmithing of one of them, but they're essentially wordsmithing. So there have been discussion primarily about plastic versus paper, and I just wanted to address that in particular. Before I mention that, I want to say that this is in support of a statewide ban on plastic with a 10-cent fee. That is what is active currently in the state, and that is what we would like to support first. Because there is an active bill, even though it wasn't in the budget, we're urging that to still be a consideration for the governor. So that brings me to the point of the difference between plastic and paper. The resolution does point out that we would prefer a ban on both paper and plastic, recognizing the environmental impacts on paper. However, in your packets before the meeting, I gave you all the first five pages of a report by the Equinox Center. This was a report that was used as a reference by the New York State Plastic Bag Task Force as one of their main references. And I want to specifically point out on page 3, there is a set of charts. There's two pie charts. And what it shows is that the overall use prior to a plastic bag ban with a fee has about 75% of the use of bags overall coming from plastic. And it has a very small percentage coming, well, 0% coming from paper. So none, primarily, according to this, in this study that was done in California, which is the only state that has a statewide ban. After this plastic bag ban with the 10% fee, the total amount of single-use bags that were used was 16. So it went from 78% of people using single-use bags to 16% of the carryouts coming from single-use bags. Although those single-use bags were paper, which means that there was an increase in paper use, the overall use of single-use bags was profoundly decreased from a total of 78% to 16%, as pointed out in the resolution. So when we do talk about paper and all of the harmful impacts of paper, I totally agree, but the overall use is significantly less. And I would point out on the subsequent page, point two, less energy is required, more water is required, less solid waste is generated, and fewer GHGs are emitted from the life cycles of bag use profiles achieved with a paper, with a plastic bag ban plus fees. So the overall environmental impact is significantly less, even though paper does increase. So that's the one point that I did want to make.
Thanks, Anna. Any other discussion? Mike.
Should I do it now? All right. Because I'm going to use the same chart. You're going to love this part. I tell you, I feel like I'm in that movie Good Burger where he walks in and he just wants some soda. No, I don't need the cup. Just pour it right here in my hands. So it's interesting the chart he brings out.
Because the chart is interesting. Because we're going to pull up some plastic bags.
Okay, tourism folks. I'm watching a show. We
so this is 1,000, right? That's 1,200 plastic bags, and this is 1,200 paper bags. So we're just going to throw this away, right? This goes to zero, so that's great. Here's the problem. This grows by 5 times. So we go from 3% to over 15%. So we're trading this for this. Yeah, that's a problem. Here's why that's a problem. You know, some people are saying, oh, we're going to get 10% per bag, or we're going to get 5 cents per bag. Who cares? Who cares if you get 5 or 10 cents? Look at the number of cans that aren't returned in New York State. $102 million in 2016. Granted, a lot of them went to recycling. A lot of them didn't. Right? That's over 2 billion cans and bottles that didn't get returned. I just think we look at landfills the wrong way. Landfills are not an infinite resource. They are a finite resource. They are like oil. They are like coal. Once they are gone, they are gone. When Seneca Mills closed, we are not going to be reciting a landfill anywhere near Tompkins County. I don't think you're going to get one in New York State. So where is all this trash going to go? A couple of weeks ago, we voted to get rid of, we don't want this incinerator right in upstate New York. I don't know what we think we're going to do with all this trash. We're going to literally have to turn to Sweden's model and start burning the trash. So I think we need to relook at what we're doing. I mean, I'm just looking around our office. You know, the guy that created Keurig, he hates himself now. He thinks he did the worst thing for the environment ever. I mean, right across the street, I went and had dinner. There. Then we have these little milk containers. There. Luna bars. Not going to say where I got this from. But this is the kind of stuff that is ending up in the ocean. These plastic bags make up such a little portion of what we're doing. And I just think we're on the wrong path. You know, I look at things like this, and it just we don't even rationalize what we're going to do before we go and do it. We think this sounds great. People, you know, you've got children that can get behind this, and they think they're doing the right thing, and yet, I'm telling you, it's like bamboo flooring. Everybody thought bamboo flooring was awesome. Like, oh, it's sustainable. look at that. We can grow it so quickly. Yeah, Indonesia said we can grow it really quickly. We're going to clear cut our forests and then we're going to grow bamboo because the Americans are so into this. And I just see this as being the same thing. You know, I'm going to close with this. This big pile, right? This is not recyclable. These paper bags, this is it for this. These don't go and get recycled in anything because eventually the fiber in paper gets too small and you can't do anything with it. That's why they're great in your garden, to keep the weeds down, because there's no nutrition left in them. So these just literally are like the worst thing ever, whereas the plastic bag just doesn't take up that much room. They take up less room. They're easier to make. They're less. We've already gone through all this the last time. So I don't know. I'm hoping you folks will reconsider. I don't think you will. But, you know, what are you going to do? But to answer somebody else what they said, yes, I expect advisory commissions to actually go and do some of the research. So for people that say, oh, my gosh, you went after this. Yeah, you know what? I'm sorry. I have a lot of things to do. This is what I rely on advisory committees to do. This is what I rely on the STPB to do. I do not want to dig down into every single thing that people apply to us for money to do. That's why I have people there to do those kind of things. At least I hope we do. Now, if we want to revisit this whole thing in the 2019 budget, let's have at it. But I don't really understand what we're kind of doing with all this stuff. So thank you for listening. I appreciate your time. Have a good night.
Leslie, you want to follow that?
Of course.
That's wonderful.
It's artistic and dramatic. Yeah. You should know me by now. Come on, bang the other one down. Go for it.
We're having too much fun here tonight.
Man, you make a good argument, my friend. And thank you for the show and tell. I was getting disappointed earlier because I didn't see it. So I really appreciate it. So it's interesting that this is here. Some own in-my-face practical research this past week that I didn't plan for. My family and I happen to be in Massachusetts, and they have abandoned plastic bags. And I go to the grocery store. I didn't know that. And I was expecting to get a plastic bag because goodness knows we have wet clothes we need to transport back to Ithaca and reuse those plastic bags for that. And they said, no, you got to pay $10 for, or 10 cents for a paper bag.
$10.
I was out of there. But it's interesting to watch because the paper bag couldn't do what I wanted it to do, not just for transporting clothes, but even to bring our groceries, because they aren't well built. They're pretty flimsy. And I thought, well, I don't like this, and partly because I've been used to going and getting my plastic bag. I also see the other side of the arguments that people made about plastic bags and where they end up. So I just wanted to share that I worry, one, about this 10 cent, and I was going to ask a question just about the resolution. Is that 10 cent the fee per bag that the stores are going to cost? Is that what's in the resolution for the state? Because, Mike, I was getting a little confused with you because I wasn't sure if that 10 cent is what I get when I show up to the store with my bag. Because you started talking about nobody returns the bottles and cans. So I wanted to clarify that, one, because we also have to think about economics for folks. And hopefully there's someone who is going to be putting together a bunch of reusable fabric bags that can be donated. Because at the store, the grocery store we were, you can buy a reusable bag, but it was $5. The paper bag wasn't reusable. After we got home, I hold the bottom because the groceries are falling out. But it was $5 to get one of those. So the economics of it bothers me because I want to make sure that whatever it is that we're doing, and even we're doing statewide, that we take into consideration people who probably wouldn't be able to afford that. And if there's something in place
to help support that as well. I like looking at things holistically. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Anna, do you want to get Annie go first?
Well, I just wanted to answer her question.
Yeah,
and then
do.
I'm gonna,
and then Ann, then Mike.
So the 10 cents is what is the fee for the bag that people mm-hmm. pay. And that money goes into, there's a certain percentage, a very small percentage that goes to the store, but a majority of it goes into a state fund for environmental issues and low-income community. There's a whole slew of social justice and environmental justice initiatives where that fund is used for. So.
Supposed to be used for.
I'm just stating what the law says.
Thank you.
Ann.
Thank you, everybody, and thanks, Mike, for your demonstration. And so we met with some of the legislators, the new legislators. We met with Barb Ekstrom and some other folks over at the Recycling Center Materials Man. I can never get the name right because it's changed over the years that I've been here. And so we discussed this issue, and probably apparent to a lot of folks that reusable, Brian said earlier, so bags made out of materials that are already here, to divert those to be made into bags seems like the best alternative. And we also discussed as far as getting those to people so that people that are of low income or if there's some other way to like have them at the stores already and or to have boxes there like that Green Star and some other stores already do. So she has already thought about that, and I would want to have a whole plan ready ahead of time so we're not creating a hardship for people and making sure we're not creating another problem.
Thanks, Ann. Mike Lane and then Amanda.
Not going to be able to support this resolution, and I feel bad about that because I know how hard the folks at the Environmental Management Council have talked about this and looked into it. I'm going to talk about a little bit of history. I have been a real supporter of recycling since going back to my time as mayor of the village of Dryden in the 80s, 1980s and 90s. Strong supporter through the New York State Conference of Mayors of the original bottle bill for deposits on returnable bottles, which overnight, when the state legislature finally put that through in my village, changed the whole landscape, where we used to see smashed bottles all over the playgrounds and streets. They were now being returned for the nickels. We've had a pretty successful recycling effort here in Tompkins County, and the people pay for that through a recycling fee. Let's not forget that. They pay to have those recyclables picked up. Every unit is charged $55 in the county.
Per year.
Per year, yep. That does some other things other than pick up the recycling. It maintains our closed landfills and some other things. But it's pretty serious what we've asked people to do here for this program. Recycling has expanded to everything, including architectural features and other things that we can have, reused electrical equipment and things like that. It's pretty important, and we've been a leader, and I think Barbara Ekstrom and her staff have done a wonderful job. But I can only think of one thing, and I may be wrong, that we've ever banned from the waste stream, and that was microbeads. It's something that people can't see, could be ingested, something that they really couldn't find out. Now, I may be wrong, but that's the only one I can remember. Now we're talking about banning something from the waste stream. And I think that it's something that people rely on and use and have the alternative. I didn't bring any giant Legos like Mike did to put on the table. But for years I've gone where the stores offer them, I've asked for paper bags instead of plastic. But talking to a local supermarket owner in Dryden. He brought to my attention something, and Leslie, this is sort of about what you're thinking about, maybe. The paper bag has to be carried by the person who is the customer up in the arms. Plastic bags can be carried down because they have handles on them. Yes, I realize cloth bags can you can do that too, but I like the idea that there's a choice for people. There are lots of things that we don't recycle. We don't recycle green glass, for example, but we haven't banned beer bottles and wine bottles. One of the worst things is we don't recycle styrofoam. And I'm not saying it's our fault, but we don't have a way to do that. And I wish we did. People would love to be able to recycle their styrofoam. Everything, and that's used in everything from packing to your meat trays that you buy when you buy a steak at the supermarket. We don't recycle polystyrene, hard plastics. We don't recycle, and we aren't talking about banning those. We're not talking about banning other kinds of plastic bags. What about dry cleaner bags? What about frozen food bags? What about the bags that your clothes come when you order online from Amazon or somebody else? We're not talking about banning those. We don't do a good job at recycling because most of the bottles that come into the recycling center, all the bottles that come in the recycling center that have deposits on them, we ignore. We lose 7.5 cents for every can or bottle that comes into the recycling center because we don't separate those out and return them for deposits. Our recycling contractor says they can't do that economically. But those are deposits that are lost. Stores do have to collect plastic bags, and a lot of people do bring them back. But we don't always. I know everybody doesn't do that, and it's hard. We can come up with a program to have staff now that go out to communities every week and collect organic waste. But we have to ban plastic bags. We can't collect those. So I'm having some trouble with this. Our recycling is wonderful, but it's not perfect. And I don't think the answer to it is to ban the kinds of bags that people use.
Thank you, Mike. Amanda, and then I'm going to take a shot, too.
Okay, great. Thanks. I really appreciated your demonstration, Mike. Thank you. One thing I take issue with is your suggestion that the EMC hasn't done their work. And I think that they have. I think that people studied this years ago and it didn't pass then. I think that people have been studying it and reading and doing the work, and you're exactly right. That's why they're there, is to do that. And they're doing it, from my perspective, as a new person on that board. And to your point, Mike, about the styrofoam, hang on a few months. We're getting there.
Glad to hear it. Glad, very much to hear it.
That's something that I'm looking forward to. I know Barb Ekstrom is very much wanting to tackle styrofoam. And I think, you know, my response or my point is that this is one step that we can take. This isn't the answer. It's not going to solve the world's problems. It's not going to make it so that the seals and the sea turtles don't die from plastic. But it's one thing that we can do locally, and it might make an impact somehow. And from there, I'm committed to working on styrofoams and working on plastic straws and working on utensils and, you know, doing all that other stuff because it's very important to me. And my last thought is just that this is just the beginning. Like, this is we're not even talking about banning it now. We're talking about telling the governor that this is important to us. So, you know, we're going to have this discussion again because it's going to come up again after we do a lot more studying and talking to all the players, talking to the grocery stores. It's going to come up again. So hang on to your display. Thanks.
Thanks, Amanda. I'm going to take a minute, and then Anne and Leslie, do you have your hand up? Okay. To me, this is not an either-or. I mean, the bill that's in front of the legislature is sort of, you know, talks about these two bags. What we're really talking about is changing behavior, and we just need to kick ourselves in the pants to get people to do this. You know, I've had cloth bags forever, and this year I finally figured out, you know, okay, get in the habit, put them in your car, use them. And I mean, I don't think I've ever bought any of them. They just end up like AFCU and I don't know, conferences. Like I seem to just have a closet full of cloth bags I never bought. But I think we should investigate whether maybe there's a couple of businesses that would be willing to put advertising on, and we develop a program that make sure every WIC parent has, you know, five bags to go home with the groceries, or and everybody in DSS, you hand them out to everybody so that they're available. I think it's really something where we just really have to change behavior. And I agree with Amanda. It's a step. It's something that we can all learn to do. We really can. Anna and then Leslie.
I'm going to go back to this lovely article that we're toying with back and forth, because I love your exhibit and I want you to keep bringing it back. But I do find it really interesting that it does say, science says that a plastic bag ban plus fee successfully reduces the volume of single-use bags deployed, the volume. So, you know, I see this. I see the difference, and absolutely, and I'm all there with you. But if we're going on the science of the environmental impact, and you're talking about volume, and we're looking at the same thing, and it says that, and I just wanted to point that out as one thing. And I loved that you said recycling, because I'm going to give a plug to paper bag floors. Anyone who's been at my house and you want to, like, find a way to recycle, do a Google search for plastic bag floors, because I made my living room.
Paper bag floors.
I mean, sorry, paper bag floors. Thank you. Because I made my living room and my bedroom out of recycled paper bags. So if you want pictures of it, I'll share those, and that will be my exhibit. I do love also that what's brought up is the ban on microbeads. I think that's really important. And one of the things that's been brought up a lot is that plastic breaks down into microplastics and then go into the water at a much smaller amount, and then we drink them and they're in the air. So I think that's actually a really good reason to ban them. So that was one of the few arguments. And the last thing I'll say is Green Star does recycling. And I bring loads of my bags back there, and I think that I just want to say, Annie, that was a great idea, and that we all could be recycling. So, yeah.
Leslie, and then Anne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to keep emphasizing for me the importance of the economics of this. Like, I come from a developing country where this is a no-brainer. We didn't have plastic bags. Before carrying your groceries on your head in a wicker basket was popular, we were doing it. Before collecting rainwater was the thing of the day, we were doing it, but we were considered backwards people and third world folks. So I don't want anybody to walk away thinking that I'm not all about environmental protection. I want to make sure that that's clear. What I am about is understanding that the economics will work for folks. When my agency is hosting an event and we go and say we want to go with recycled, you know, spoons and forks and that sort of stuff, it cost us six times more than it would for us to buy the other stuff. We don't necessarily want to buy the other stuff, but we can't afford to do, you know, the good stuff. We can't afford to do that. And that's an agency. I'm thinking about individuals in this sense. So for me, I'm looking at the bigger picture around this. You know, the same thing goes for food.
You know, the food that's supposed to be good for you, the organic stuff, you have to pay an arm and a leg for. You know, versus the one that, you know, all kinds of stuff is in. But we want people to eat healthy, and we want people to not use plastic bags, and we want them to not do these things. We really have to, and I am saying it loud, that I'm hoping that our state government is also thinking about this, because it's extremely, extremely important.
Thank you, Leslie. Anne, and then Henry. And I know everybody's really feels strongly about this, but and the tourism people are learning a lot tonight, but let's try to move this along. So thanks.
Leslie, I just want to go on what you said and then add a couple of quick things. So if the state doesn't pass this, which I'm hearing that it's likely that the state won't pass the plastic bag ban, and if we come later to look at this for a local issue, that to me would be a big consideration as far as giving somebody a 10-cent credit for bringing a bag back, like that I prefer at stores. So I'm glad you brought that up. And I just wanted to show some things I took out of our legislator recycling bin earlier today to bring home. And this is called, at the recycling center, this is film. It's in the film category. And so this is like dry cleaner bags, clothes bags, bread bags, and things like that. You can collect them, but you can't put them in with regular recycling. The single stream, you have to collect them. And I call myself an environmentalist, but I'm also very busy, so I buy a lot of food that's pre-prepared, bread and different things and bags. And so over the course of a year, I'm also don't go to the recycling center very often, so over the course of a year, I had a big bag like this in my basement of stuff. I brought one big bag, so you can bring that for free. And then I just also wanted to put in there aluminum, as Mike Sigler talked about with me earlier today. You know, there's different ways to collect small pieces of aluminum. You have to put them in a little an aluminum can, like beer tops or bottle tops, and like the foil off of some yogurts and things. Put them in there, and then put the top back on, squish it together, because otherwise they fall, and I think it was two, they have to be two inch by two inch, or they fall through the machines too. So you think you're recycling, but if it's not big enough, all of that stuff falls through.
And can those plastic films go in with your plastic bags to the grocery store when you take your bags back to the grocery store?
I don't know. I use reusable bags, so I don't.
Okay.
I don't know.
Henry, and then Mike Sigler.
I see this as a small step, Mike, in terms of going on the environmental ladder, just a step in the right direction. In fact, I noticed that when I was doing some research on this, that L.A., in fact, has curbside pickup of plastic bags. Now, I know it'd be difficult to do here, but they do have it. And, in fact, maybe your idea of having the weekly food scrap could also maybe we expand it and have plastic bags recycled that way. I also checked out, and I noticed in Europe, where their grocery stores are much more far ahead of us in terms of environmental concerns, because they have plastic-free aisles in stores in Europe. They also have a place where you bring your own container, and you get the amount of food that you want as opposed to wasting food. Those are buying a pound of spaghetti, get a half pound of spaghetti. And so, again, these are some of the things I learned. So, again, I just think that we're behind, and it is just a small step, and hopefully the right direction.
Thanks, Henry. Okay, quickly, Mike.
I will be quick. I just wanted to point out that Equinox Center, this report you gave me, does no longer exist. So EquinoxCenter.org is now Be Proven, Be Stronger, fitness workouts for her and him. So I don't know. I sorry now I relied on your report.
Okay. I'm pretty sure no minds are being changed. So are we ready for a vote?
Roll call, please.
One. We have, and Kathy, thank you, Kathy. I'm so glad you're here. We have the revised amendment that was offered. So we're voting to
approve
the substitution, and then we'll vote on the amendment, and then on the motion. Okay, all in favor of the motion with the revisions, please raise your hand.
You mean substituting?
Just a substitute, that's right. Yeah. All right, please keep your hands up a second. All right. Opposed? That's 11 to 1. Right? Okay, so this is revised motion is on the floor. All in favor, please raise your hands.
Roll call, please.
Mr. Klein?
Yes.
Ms. Corman?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
No.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Sigler?
No.
Ms. Black?
Yes.
Ms. Champion?
Yes.
Ms. Dawson?
Yes.
Mr. Granison?
Yes.
Ms. Kellis?
Yes.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
10 ayes, 2 noes.
Thank you, folks. The resolution is passed. We appreciate the lively conversation. Speaking of which, let's get to Resolution F. And that is packet page 14. Anna.
So this is for the award of 2018 Arts and Culture Organizational Development Grants, DAC ID 7701. I'd like to move it.
Seconded by Deborah. And I'm going to really ask people to try to say what you need to say in one round. Okay, let's really try to move this along. Dan.
Thank you. I would like to move an amendment. Amendment would be to add one resolve at the end, and it would, you all have copies of it in your red folders. I'll read it out loud for the benefit of the public. It would say, resolve further that the Arts and Culture Organizational Development Grants budget line be increased from $217,870 to $300,000 for 2018, with the increase being taken from the room occupancy tax-funded Tompkins County Tourism Program fund balance, and that the Arts and Culture Organizational Development Grant Review Panel be reconvened to consider allocating the additional funds.
Is there a second?
I will second it for purposes of discussion.
Okay. Henry?
I would just second it.
Okay. All right. Well, let's... Henry raised his hand, so thanks. All right. Seconded by Henry. All right. Discussion. This is on the amendment. Dan?
I'm going to read a prepared statement. It's not going to be as dramatic as Mike's performance, which I think deserves a theater grant.
I expected a costume. No.
The object of art is to give life a shape. That's a quote by William Shakespeare, and I wanted to open with a Shakespeare quote because you are not likely to hear it again in Tompkins County this year. You are not likely to hear it in Tompkins County this year because we, the Tompkins County Legislature, are about to vote to completely eliminate funding for the Ithaca Shakespeare Company. They used to get $5,000 a year from the county, but we are about to vote to completely eliminate that funding for 2018. That's $5,000 out of $2.8 million that the county took in through its hotel room tax last year. $2.8 million. No local property tax money goes into that fund. It does not cost our residents a dime. The fund is earmarked for tourism purposes and specifically arts and culture. $2.8 million. And for reasons that I do not understand, we feel the need to eliminate the Ithaca Shakespeare Company's $5,000 allocation. It's a real shame that we were fighting about arts funding, and it's a real shame that we're having this fight in Tompkins County of all places. And I'm saddened and puzzled by this, and I know that there are people in this room who disagree with me, but I can tell you that out there, the people that we are elected to represent, they are as puzzled as I am. They do not see the logic of why we, the Tompkins County Legislature, would allow operational funding to be cut from our local arts and culture organizations at the same time that the hotel tax revenue is going through the roof. By my count, we had 94 county residents email into the legislature this past week to say that they support using some of the hotel tax surplus to restore the cuts made to the arts and culture organizations and to fund them to an appropriate level. In my time in the legislature, I've never seen such a large response from the public. The public does not like to see these organizations put into a Hunger Games scenario where they have to compete against each other for money. They want the problem fixed. So what do we, the legislature, know that the public does not know? Why is the public so overwhelmingly in favor of this, but tonight many legislators in this room to plan to vote against this? The public knows as much as we do. There are no secrets around this issue. There's nothing that we need to discuss in executive session. There are no personnel issues that we're not permitted to talk about in public. There are no lawsuits involved here. The public knows everything we know, and the public has spoken clearly and overwhelmingly about its preferences. A handful of people on a board, people that are not elected and that control $2.8 million of public money, have come out against the proposal. I know that. And I thank them for their work and the advisory capacity that they served to the legislature and for the strong tourism program that they've helped develop. But I know who I work for. I work for the public. The public has asked for a solution to this problem, and I am offering a solution to this problem. There has been a lot of confusion created by some legislators who feel that they are not in a position to solve this problem. But after everything that's been said, I still feel that this is not actually particularly complicated. A, several arts and cultural organizations have had their operational funding cut for 3 years now. This is simply a fact. B, the hotel tax has been running a huge surplus for many years now. 7% average increase each year for the last 10 years. So there's plenty of money there to fund the operational budgets of these organizations adequately without taking the money away from anyone else. This is also a fact. And C, these organizations are extremely popular with the public, and the public has spoken overwhelmingly in favor of increasing their funding. This solution has been endorsed by two former legislators who were authors of the hotel tax when it was established some 25 years ago. Both Frank Proto and Nancy Schuler, who were legislators at that time, have said that part of the intention of establishing the hotel tax was to offer consistent, reliable funding to our local arts and cultural organizations. Gene McFeeters, the former president of the Chamber of Commerce, endorsed this solution. The Chamber of Commerce oversees the Convention and Visitors Bureau. The last two legislature liaisons to the Tourism Board have endorsed this solution to the problem. Three legislators who are now retired voted for this proposal in the form in which it was presented last year. The legislators who voted for this last year had combined experience of more than 50 years in the legislature. The former director of finance for Tompkins County has endorsed increasing this budget line. The list that I just recited consists of people who probably know more about tourism and funding in Tompkins County than anyone. So you can disagree, but please do not suggest that this approach is somehow reckless or simplistic. I will also point out that despite intense debate about this issue, no one has offered another solution to the problems the funding cuts have caused these organizations. I was not elected to just talk about problems. I was elected to fix problems. The public has spoken loud and clear, and they want the problem fixed, and I am offering a solution. A yes vote on this amendment solves a problem that was first brought to light a year ago but has not been fixed. A yes vote on this amendment will make the arts and culture organizations happy. It will make the public happy. Taxes will not be affected. There are no losers in this proposal. This is actually not a hard one. Let's vote on this and get back to the issues that actually are difficult. Thank you.
I have Shauna, Anna, and then Deborah.
First off, I'd like to thank everyone that attended this evening and voiced their concerns, and the many people that have written emails over the past few weeks. Like many of you, I am a patron of the arts in our community. I attend and donate to the local theaters and arts programs. My family has enjoyed Science Center, PRI, Cuga Nature Center memberships, and we even host stage crew from the Hangar Theater in my home throughout the summer. I truly understand a concern when the information received is that funding to some of our county's most valuable assets are being reduced. With that said, I have met with Planning and Development Department, the State Theater, and Hangar Theater, and I want to share with you the information I have discovered. Clearly, the problem is complex. There are many different pots of funding that are used for different organizations that offer different products. The ACOG grant is a simple funding source that allocates funding to a few providers. There have been newcomers that have been eligible and have also received this grant funding. In some cases, that means it has reduced the amount from the older recipients like the Hangar Theater. The actual county funding for the single grant has increased in the past year 11%. What I foresee happening in the upcoming year with a new and convened advisory board, tourism director, and this conversation, there will be a revamping of the current grant process. This is a good thing because the past process has been tedious for both applicants and those reviewing applications. It also historically provided inconsistent grant funding for operation budgets. I also believe that we must work with the current structure of the Strategic Tourism Planning Board. We need to have a dialogue about our goals and discussion and what we would like to see in the upcoming years. I would agree 100% that we need to increase funding to our nonprofits. However, there's a proper way and channels that we must go through with the budget process. By allocating money from one area to another without process puts a band-aid on a broken system. Over the next 3 to 6 months, legislators will have discussions and look to the highly qualified and competent Strategic Tourism Planning Board for suggestions on improving the grant process for both the applications and the board doing the reviews. Ideally, we could have solutions that are suited for the 2019 budget. I have full faith that together we will reach an agreement that provides equity and funding with our current arts providers. Thank you.
I've got Anna and then Deborah.
I do also, I want to thank the community for their amazing support.
Closer to the mic.
I said I wanted to thank the community also for their amazing support for arts and culture. We have seen an outpouring that is inspiring, to say the least. I also want to thank the dedication of the STPB board that is like no other that we have seen, and that you're all still sitting here and the work that you have done. I will be ending this and then joining one of the committees to work on the grant cycle that I haven't been able to work on, so I'm very well aware of how many hours that you all put in. I very much appreciate that, in fact, the Shakespeare Company was brought up in particular, because last year there was a grant, the total grant received by the Shakespeare Company was $24,000. Only $5,000 of that actually came from ACOG. This year they didn't qualify for ACOG, so if we give all of that money unilaterally to ACOG, that means that this exact same organization that was just argued for would not be available to receive. That funding would not be available to them through the other grants, which they do actually qualify for. So I think that it's really important to recognize that there are many arts and culture organizations that do qualify for funding through tourism, but not through ACOG. And so unilaterally giving that money to one instead of any of the others through an objective process that our STPB board of experts goes through would mean that we would not be allowing any of them to be available for that surplus. So I think that is really particularly important to consider. One of the things that I do want to point out, I think that this campaign that you are bringing up and that has been going on in the community does acknowledge that there is a passion for arts and culture. My experience and several of the people that I've spoken with, there is a confusion between arts and culture, of which there is profound support, and ACOG, And there is a belief that ACOD is all of the funding for arts and culture. And as such, people have voiced their interest to see it supported. But when I get emails, people say, I want the Cherry Arts Theater. I want funding to go to Ithaca Opera. I want funding to go to Ithaca Ballet. I want funding, and none of those are ACOD recipients. So that's really telling for me that there's misunderstanding in the community between what is recognized as arts and culture and what this resolve does, which is particular focus on one of 10 groups within arts and culture recipients. I do lastly want to say, and I'm not going to mention all the arguments because all of you guys have read the article that I wrote, you read Dan's article that he wrote, you've read absolutely everything. I actually think that the intention that has been underlying, Dan, your comments that I really appreciate, is actually well-intentioned and I'm aligned with, which is that recognition that arts and culture do need to be looked at more carefully and that we really want to make sure that they get properly funded. So I respect that, but what I would like to see is a respect for the process of supporting our experts in doing that evaluation through their normal process. They're right now in the middle of a budget season. They've already started to go through the process of identifying grants. I'd like to see that finish and support them in that. And the last thing that I'll say about that is that every STPB member that I have spoken with has recognized a need to update and streamline and make this process more transparent. So undermining them when they actually all agree with the fundamental tenet of what was being put forward in the campaign and this additional resolve, I think has been missed in this entire process. And I'd really like to support them in their mission to support you and to support all of us in making sure arts and culture is sufficiently funded.
Thank you, Anna. Deborah, and if there aren't other folks, I'll put myself in line. All right, Mike Lane, and I'm going to get in here at some point. So I've got Deborah and then Mike Lane.
Well, first off, I want to thank Dan for bringing this issue up because I would have never in a million years dove into the Marianas Trench depth of arts funding in Tompkins County that this has forced me to look at. And it's a mess. I would certainly hope that we're at a point now where you've brought this to everyone's attention. Everyone realizes it's a mess. And we can go forward to revamp the process, make it simpler, make it more transparent. Maybe instead of giving 81 grants to God knows how many organizations, we can award grants to a single organization and lump everything they qualify for into one grant. This would certainly eliminate a lot of the administrative work that gets done. And so maybe a little more of that room tax money could go to grantees rather than to the county for administration. Maybe we don't need to be giving money to TCAD from the room taxes. A couple of my constituents mentioned this to me. People who are involved in arts organizations who say, we've noticed that the amount of money for arts and cultural organizations is less because TCAD gets more, and we can't see what TCAD does for tourism. So that's an option. I think there are ways we could make this simpler. I think there are ways that we could grow the pie that's available for these organizations. But I don't know that the way to do it is in the middle of a grant cycle, because the problem with process is, if process is not consistent, if process is not predictable, if process is not fair, then it falls apart. Nobody respects the system. And that's a result I truly want to avoid. And just one last thing. Yeah, 94 people wrote emails, and I saw all those emails, and almost to a person, those emails said, restore the arts funding that's been cut. The question is, was the arts funding really cut? And that, I think, is a misapprehension. And when I sent my constituents my explanation of what went into the grant funding process, they all went, oh, we had no idea it was so complicated. Maybe we don't really know what's going on here. So in fairness, I think we want to do the right thing. I think we want to have as much available for these organizations as we can, but we want to have it within a predictable, fair, and reliable process that meets everyone's needs.
Okay, thanks, Deborah. I got Mike Lane, Leslin, and then Henry.
Pat spent a lot of time thinking about this, thinking about a lot about Dan's position. Dan, thank you very much for being tenacious about this. You brought it up not now to begin with. You brought it up last year during budget cycle, which was the proper way to start thinking about this. I've seen some of the back and forth emails among the legislators, not only what has come from the arts community. I have not liked it. I think they're trying to hear, sometimes we get a legislator or legislators who are very strongly committed to a particular position. And sometimes what happens is there, the others who are not happy that that person doesn't agree with them, they try to compartmentalize that person as to, you know, he's a kook or he's not thinking about this right, or he's not entitled to this, to have that kind of opinion. He's not representing the people. Those things happen from time to time to people. I've experienced that myself, and I'm going to take an aside and just tell you a history of one. Quite a number of years ago, we were getting ready to build the emergency response center, and we had to select a location for it. And there was a strong legislator who really wanted us to, at the suggestion of an architect in town, to put it up near Ithaca College on the Ithaca Fire Department site, wanted us to build over that building and build parking on this little postage stamp thing, wanted us to build parking under that. I argued it was a terrible location if we had a real emergency, ice storms or something like that, that it was going to be very expensive, much larger than our budget would stand, and yet I was compartmentalized as being just a kook on it. And it was a vote of 14-1, and guess I was the one lone person out. Well, guess what happened? We didn't build it at Ithaca College where 14 people voted to build it because the cost of it was so expensive, and we built it at the airport, which made a much more logical place to have it. I just want to say that sometimes being the lone person out doesn't mean you're wrong. And, Dan, I think you're right here. But I also agree that there is the process that we've gone through. I can remember the old STPB years ago, before it was modernized, dominated by hoteliers who thought the only thing they could spend money on was something that meant they got a customer in their hotel overnight. And we had to, on the floor, argue to put money into the allocations for community celebrations, for example. That's not the kind of STPB we have now. We've got a much better, much more professional, much more dedicated group. And so that's why I'm having trouble not supporting what they want to do. I will not vote for the amendment tonight. But, Dan, I'm telling you, if something isn't done here, because we've heard so much from the arts community that does so much for everybody, if something isn't done here, next year I'll vote for this amendment. If you bring it through budget, if nothing is happening. And, yes, arts, they're vociferous, and they ought to be. They are a big part of our tourism draw into Tompkins County. I personally think they don't do enough for outreach into the rural areas. I'm a rural rep, and we hardly ever see anybody from the arts community except in downtown Ithaca. But it isn't the fault here that deserves a slap at our STPB. So I've talked long enough, but I want to say you're right to do this. It's all right to be alone, and we shouldn't look down on you at all for that, and that we need to support our volunteer groups the best we can, but not always. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I've got Leslin and then Henry, and I will ask Amanda and Dave and Mike Sigler if they want to speak as well. So I've got Leslin and then Henry.
Thank you, Martha, and thank you, Mike. Deborah, I wince when you said it's a mess, because I don't think it's a mess. I'm not sure how you came to that characterization. I actually appreciated what I consider to be some healthy debate around this issue, and not anything messy or ugly, but it shouldn't rise to the level of ugly. Art is not ugly. Art is fun and exciting and engaging and intelligent and intriguing. It's all of those things, but not ugly. And we don't want to paint that picture of it by any means. I certainly can relate to what Mike is talking about. When I first got on this legislature, there was still work being done in shaping how the STPB did business that we asked them to do. Last year when you brought this up, Dan, I was in full support of this, but I said, can we meet with the folks who make these decisions and say, hey, here is where, as a collective body, our interest is seeing a 2% increase for these organizations, funding them to the 2016, I think it was, or 14 levels or 15 levels or whatever it was. Can we bring them back up to that level, et cetera, et cetera? I don't know that conversation happened. At least I was not a part of that conversation, and I want to say it loud and clear on this floor that I'm hoping that's the conversation with our STPB members sitting here that we can engage in, so that we are collectively coming to a decision about what funding would look like for ACON, what funding would look like for the others, because ultimately we're responsible. We have that vote. We appoint this STPB to be stewards of that money, but we still have to vote on it, and we still have to be responsible to our constituents when they ask questions. So I am asking for that conversation to happen so that this does not get any uglier than it already is. It doesn't need to be. But that we can collectively come to some solution that would make sure that our arts organizations, that would make sure that the things that are the organizations are out there looking for support and funding and are scrambling. You know, I don't know what it's like to be a starving artist. I was about to say that, but that would be a lie. But as an artist, I know what it's like when I'm trying to apply for those grants and to get support. And if you're a nonprofit organization, I know it's even harder. So we want to be in a place where we're supporting that. This is not the time for us to be cherry-picking about whether TCAD does what it does. Or I've been on this legislature for almost, 18 years now, and I've been saying I think the airport should get some of this money. I've been saying that because I think the airport plays a very key role in tourism. But I did not forward their conversation, and I'm hoping it could be part of the things that we talk about. So please, can we have a conversation. I don't know who's going to do the doodle poll, somebody, that we can all sit together. God, don't ask me to do it. I know the press button turns stuff on. Doodle poll, no. That we can talk about 2019 budget. It should have happened for this budget. It didn't. 2019 budget, what is it if we want to see a percentage of this and a percentage of that and percentage, because ultimately it's our decision, but we want to do it with your support and your knowledge as well. So I'm asking for that to happen so we're not in the same place again next year.
Thank you, Leslie. Henry, and then Ann.
Dan, I did not originally support your position, but I asked you. You talked to me. You asked me for. I asked you for more information. You gave it to me. I talked to some constituents, and then I decided that, okay, it does make sense to, in fact, fund ACOD some more. And hopefully you misspoke, because you said there were no other people who proposed any of the plans. I did propose a plan. I did propose a compromise plan, suggesting that it would just be a percentage of the hotel tax. That we would state what the percentage would be, and then the STB board can work within that, taking away that decision, so that we could say, okay, that the percentage is 10%, and it will always be 10%. But, you know, I know people talk about the timing of when it's occurring, and I was here last year, sitting right over there, when Dan brought up this very issue. And I was there when Leslin talked about saying, can we do something about this? I see you as doing something about this. This is what you said would happen. So I don't see it as being ill-timed or whatever. Also, you know, what would happen now? The committee is going to meet about the surplus. after this debate, what are they going to do with the surplus? Are they going to, in fact, assign nothing to ACOD? Are they going to assign a little to ACOD? Are they going to fund ACOD to your amount? If we set a percentage, be no debate. If we say, okay, 10%, we just decide what the 217, 870, you move it up to 280, and that's it. Our hands are clean. We set a percentage and we make it. Now, you know, what are they going to do? How are they going to decide? How are they going to make those fine decisions, knowing that the legislature there's clearly a feeling of unhappiness, and that the people out there, maybe they don't know what's going on, but when the vote comes, when this is reported in the paper tomorrow, what's going to be the analysis? That, you know, that ACOD funding failed.
Okay, thanks, Henry. Ann, and then Mike Sigler.
Thank you. I want to thank Dan for bringing this issue up, because I learned a lot of information from the information that you presented, other legislators, members of ACOD and STPB. I learned a lot from constituents, writing in emails, and talking with a lot of different folks about this. So for me, what it boils down to is I trust the STPB and ACOD organization, the boards that we have entrusted with this. And if we're going to look at doing something different, I think that's a different discussion of taking away that power from them. And when I did look at all the information, I tried to, best I could, to not look at personalities as far as who's saying what. I tried to look at all the information and look at the merits of all the details. And so to me, that's what these boards are doing. And it's a hard job. They're, you know, what they're doing is very hard. So I support them, and I, at this time, don't want to subvert what they're doing or micromanage. Certainly don't want to create a feeding frenzy or, as you mentioned, the Hunger Games that all these organizations are coming to the legislature or the representatives and asking for this or that. We have a very civil, organized way for people to apply for that money. So thank you.
Thanks, Ann. Mike Sigler, and then I'm going to see if Dave has anything to say, and I'll take a shot.
I'll be relatively quick. I mean, I go to all this stuff. I mean, when we pass things, I literally go to the show. So, and it's important that I mention that because, you know, I went and Mr. Stoll sitting behind me here, and I went and saw Camelot, you know, and I'm looking forward to seeing April. May is right around the corner. That's important. But, you know, I'm looking forward to your future show. And I went to see Shakespeare when it was in, you know, the Plantations, now renamed. I can't remember the name now that Cornell is famous. But there you go, Botanical Gardens. And, you know, Hamlet would never get elected for anything today. But I just want to say that it's important to me, like the Christmas Carol. This is why I think that we can't really undermine this group. And the reason is because a lot of things in tourism require flexibility that we as a legislature just don't have the ability to act on as quickly as they can. I mean, who would have thought that Wizarding Weekend would put that many heads in beds? I mean, literally. I mean, I remember when they called for volunteers, they were like, we were expecting like 200 people. And they got 8,000 people coming. I mean, remarkable. And then the next year it grew. And now we give them money out of one of these funds. I don't even know which fund it is, right? But I don't think we can, as a group, kind of manage that. That's why we have people that make those decisions. I always thought it was remarkable that Ithaca Fest, quick story, I had a guy, he ran a business locally, and this goes back to TCAD too. He had a guy, and he flew in because of a meeting at a business. And my friend, he picked him up at the airport, but he drove him downtown. His office is right up on Tripphammer, but he drove him downtown and through Ithaca Fest. And this guy was like, wow, there's a lot going on here. This is like the best place ever. Yeah, so he came to work here in Ithaca, and he loves it, right? It's that kind of flexibility, though, and Ithaca Fest never put in for money until recently. I could never understand that, but they just didn't. The other thing that was mentioned, too, a little bit about TCAD, too, what did I do this weekend? I went and I hiked Lick Brook. And then I went to Ithaca Beer, and we had a flight of beer, and we had a burger. And that's the kind of thing, I'm sorry, that's tourism, too.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not just about bringing in people from outside the county. If it was that, then the Kitchen Theater wouldn't get any money, right? They just wouldn't. They bring in like 14% of the people are from out of the county. But that's not why my tourism dollars are worth it, too. I want to do tourism myself in my own home. And I think a lot of people do that here. You know, they go up to Taconic Falls and they go to Ulysses and then they come back and they hit the Glenwood Pines. That is your tourism experience. And that's kind of why people live here. And that's where, I mean, I don't have a big problem. So, Dan, I appreciate you bringing it up. I'm just looking at 4/24, April 24th. 20 days, we are going to get together at a legislative retreat and we're going to go over money. And if at that point we want to put more money into the arts, yeah. And I think we need to have a kind of a broad sense of what the arts actually are. Because, yes, the Hangar is a cinder block location that I like to go to. You know, I'm looking forward to Chicago and Xanadu this year. I think that's exciting. But it's also, a cornerstone can also be an event. It's kind of like Wizarding Weekend. That's a cornerstone right now. And I don't know how long that'll last, but for now, that's a cornerstone. And that's the kind of things that I think we need that flexibility, and that's what I really appreciate that the STPB does. So, thanks.
All right, Dave, you have anything to say?
I'm going to reiterate what I said the last time, is I think we should support STPB board. And in addition to that, I want to say I agree with Leslie, and I think we should have a discussion with that board and this body and sit down and figure out what we want to do for the next year's budget so we do not have this kind of a problem. And maybe even discuss a little bit of how we're going to fix this year's problem. But certainly not undermine those people. So,
Amanda, and then I'm going to go, and then I'm going to ask for a vote. Because this is just on the amendment. There will, you know, give other things to say. That we're voting on the main motion as well. So, Amanda?
I just want to say that you guys said it all.
Oh, man, but I have stuff to say, so not quite all. Okay, so I just first I want to say
almost all.
Almost all. Okay. A couple quick things. First, I respectfully agree with somebody who said it's not a mess. It's complicated. It's really complicated. It's not a mess. No, I think it's complicated. They know how it works. It's also transparent. I would point out that on the web right now is not just the amounts that were requested by these organizations, but the amount that was granted and a one or two sentence review of each application. So each organization is right there in public with what the response of the review committee was, as well as the criteria and you know, the rules of this particular grant. So it's transparent. It's not a mess. I also want to say it's not... there's a real big difference between a percentage approach, as you said, Henry, or you know, as Dan's been talking about, and a merit-based approach. Now, that's a really big policy decision. If it's a percentage approach, it's basically kind of arbitrary. It's not merit-based. It says like you're entitled. This is your entitlement. You get this amount, and every year every group gets 2% more, let's say, or 3 or whatever it is. That's a really different program. Now, there's no specific way to say this is better than that. They have different consequences. And what I've heard from people that have talked to us and written is by being merit-based, it means that the tourism board makes really careful decisions about their priorities. These are the rules for this program because we want, in fact, for example, in 2015, there was an ACOD task force. Originally, only 8 organizations had been allowed to apply for all, with all these criteria. By 2014 or so, there was clearly more organizations that were eligible according to those criteria. There was a long task force that met. And they grappled with this specific question, should we allow other organizations to apply? The answer was yes. 3 additional organizations qualified. The answer was yes, with a very specific statement in that report saying, we understand this may mean less money for some of the prior 8 recipients. But by continuing to be merit-based, if they had the best application, if they fully documented what they wanted to do, they could still get the maximum amount. So that was a very thoughtful decision. Again, another decision I would really not like us to second guess. I would like to say that this has been a passionate debate, but not a personal one, at least from my point of view. And I think... you know, how you disagree with people can be a real art. It's what we're all trying to learn how to do. And then, you know, go on to the next issue. We vote, and then we go on to the next issue. For me, this has not been personal. This has been an educational event. And I think the public has learned a lot. In fact, so we had whatever, 85, 90, whatever those number of emails that came in. Anne and I worked a long time on a compilation of facts to respond to all the things that we had heard. We got that done by last night, sent it out, and I've sent it out to the others. So I pulled all the email addresses that came in, and I sent it to everybody who wrote to us, at least as of like 4 o'clock today. I got 2 responses that said, I don't agree with you. Everybody else responded, wow, like Deborah said, I didn't know all that. That's really interesting. Thank you for writing. Thank you for taking the time to explain all that to me. So it's wonderful. It's a celebration of the arts that this community rallies in support of the arts. That's great. That's not the same as supporting this particular one of many grant programs. A couple other quick things, and I'm sorry to go on so long, but I want to talk about TCAD a little bit. In, I think it was 2009, there was the STPB hired a consultant to come. It's called the Chamora Study, to look at what are people in our hotels, this is before Airbnb was big, what are people in our hotels, why are they here? They did a very thorough study. And the response, what they found was a very significant percentage were here for business. They weren't tourists at all. And they came and paid room tax, but they were here for business, business related in many cases to the work that TCAD does. So where's the room tax come from? A lot of it comes from TCAD's work. Another part of TCAD's work is supporting the hotels that have been built here. And this is not a little thing. The fact that we have some very nice hotels, modern properties, this is one of the reasons that our room tax has been growing. Because before this, a lot on the busy weekends, people were staying in Cortland and out of the county entirely. I think TCAD has earned a percentage of that money, and it's actually a very, very small amount of money. It's true we are going to be renegotiating that agreement this year, and I think people will be satisfied with what we come up with. I also just want to say that, I think really if we were to enable a legislator, any legislator, to kind of insert their priorities in the middle of a process when there's a very comprehensive process for a budget to be distributed, I think we might end up with what we used to have, for example, with the human services agencies. I don't know, 20-something years ago, and this happened at the city too, instead of oversight and review by the Human Services Coalition, which has another volunteer group that spends hours and hours and hours meeting and reviewing budgets, talking to executive directors, doing some site visits, reviewing all the priorities of the county and of the coalition, and they come up with their recommendations for funding. And we ask questions, they're accountable, they help us to understand these agencies and their budgets. And for the most part, we say, great, thank you so much for doing all that work, and we pass their budgets. Before we had the coalition doing that kind of review, we had every single one of those nonprofits coming to the microphone. Every single one of them was sending 20, 30, 50, we didn't have an email, letters. Anybody remember Queen
Your Old? Phone calls.
We're the same age. I wasn't here then. Okay.
I wasn't either.
But I remember, here's how old I am. Remember Queen for a Day?
Yeah.
Remember you had the
washing machines.
The people who would, the person who got the biggest prize was the one who had the saddest story. That was pretty much what our microphone was like for months. I don't think we want to go back there for the human services agencies, and I don't think we want to go back there for the arts and cultural organizations. I think this is a perfect moment to figure out how to have a thoughtful conversation with STPB and its committees and its leadership and our staff, a thoughtful conversation about what should this look like? It's, there's no such thing as a perfect program. Let's figure out how to improve it. But I think there's another way to go about it than voting for this.
I just want to apologize for the mess comment. I didn't mean to offend anyone. It was a poor word choice. I meant it was way more complicated than it needs to be. So apologies to all of you for your good work.
Okay.
I'm going to use that one. I just wrote mess, new dictionary word.
Okay.
Way more.
I'm actually not even going to ask anybody if there's any more debate. I'm just going to say, let's have a vote. Does anybody want a roll call?
On the amendment.
Yeah, right. We're on voting on the amendment. Can we just vote or do we need a roll call? Okay. Let's just vote on this proposal to add this last resolve. All in favor, please raise your hand. All opposed. That is 2-10, so the amendment fails. We are back to the main motion, which is on packet page. Remember, we were in the packet here. Packet page 14 and 15. Anna, and then Mike.
I just wanted to say thank you to Katie and Nick for all the work that you've put in, putting all those documents together and memos together to educate us. I have more tables in, my files now than I could ever want to deal with. But I know that it has been the first
month of any employee that no one would want to have as far as workload, a serious cram session to learn all of this very quickly, Nick. So thank you for all of your input to all of us. I also wanted to say thank you to Leslin for that comment of having these dynamic conversations. I really do hope that they continue and that we don't make a habit of criticizing people who feel passionate about what they're saying and hard about and working really hard. That doesn't mean it's personal. I do think that this was a very lively debate, and I, for one, am much better for it because I, being a liaison of STPB, I now know the ins and outs of it more than I ever imagined. So thank you, Dan, because I have learned a lot. And thank you to STPB, I'm very tired at this point, for all of your work. And hopefully we will have a dynamic conversation, because I know you guys have wanted it as well. And that is thank you to bringing this conversation forward. So that will happen. And who's doing the doodle poll? Not me. I'm nose, touch.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Katie,
let's
for that as well.
Show. Thanks, Anna. Mike?
Call the question.
All right. Is there a second for that? Seconded by Amanda. All in favor of calling the question? Any opposed? Well, that's pretty unanimous. That's unanimous. All right. All in favor of Resolution F in your packet. Please raise your hands. Opposed. That's 10 to 2. That passes. I would like us to take a 10-minute break, and then we will be back. Thank you. I think where we left off was legislator privilege of the floor. Mike.
I'm going to suggest that we skip it tonight.
This is not, it's not fair. Everybody be quick would be nice. Let's do quick stuff, all right? All right. Is there any legislators who want to address the public on anything else? Going once, Anne.
Just a quick announcement. April 5th to the 10th is the annual Ulysses used book sale. You also get puzzles and games. And so it's the 5th to the 10th. You can look on Facebook or on their website. They also need help with setting up and selling books and things like that. And each two-hour shift that you do, you get a free item. I already got a puzzle.
All right. Thanks, Ann. Anybody else? Okay. A quick report for myself. You remember hearing about the New York Power Authority helping us with an application for the New York geothermal project for the airport. We were quickly, shockingly quickly notified that we were accepted into the batch of the first 75 applications. That doesn't mean we get the money, right, Dave? It just means we're allowed, that NYPA. Jason, help me here.
It means we're now moving on to the next stage. It means we're moving on to the next stage of evaluation. It doesn't secure funding, but it's the next step in the process.
Right. So that was really great news, and I'm going to continue to work on that. I think that's it. What I got now? I already did those. Didn't I do them? All right, I'll do them again. All right. I'm appointing. Again, Deborah Dawson as delegate and Ann Corman as alternate to the Cuyahoga Lake Watershed Intermunicipal Organization. Thank you very much. All right, I think that's all I've got for report right now. So, Jason, County Administrator's report.
Thank you very much. In looking at the agenda earlier today, I opted to summarize the state budget rather than to go through the whole 36 pages of the NYSAC summary for you. But basically, I gave you a brief memo. I will send out to you the link to the NYSAC county impact summary. The state budget was approved this past weekend. Briefly, as I went through it, I pulled out some elements that we have discussed here locally. Obviously not everything. I'll take a little bit more of a thorough look at it. But just to recap very quickly, early voting was not funded through that budget. So while we discussed it, was it funded at the end of the day? There are some additional workforce development funds that, and it looks like they'll be accessed outside the CFA process. Julia hasn't quite figured out, or no, I should say the state hasn't quite figured out how that's going to be distributed. But when they do, she'll give me a little bit more background onto it. Medicaid assisted living program, ALP beds. There was 500 additional new beds allotted. Statewide, preference going to counties that have one or no current providers, us being one of those, which is good, as well as another $20 million for capital funds to be accessed for folks with no beds in the county or with counties that have no beds, preference given to those areas. That was something we discussed, I know, with our state representatives, as well as I know Lisa Holmes has been looking to try to find interest in some type of development, but we can't do it without the access to the beds. Jay Franklin talked about some changes in the way the STAR verification takes place. It adds an additional step, which adds some more confusion to our seniors to having to take another step to get that STAR verification. But when the process is identified, he'll work with COFA to help educate folks and help them get those STAR exemptions put in on an annual basis, the income verifications. CHIPS funds stayed flat. It's now been the third or fourth year that they have the extreme weather recovery. I think November of 2015 was the first year, so it's continued on another year, but no decrease in CHIPS funding, which is good. I'll expect Jeff to come forward with an amendment to the budget to account for the additional extreme winter recovery funds. Community college funding was a discussion point earlier where there was, I think, a proposal of reduction of $24 million. This was cut back to still a reduction, but not quite as much to about $7.6 million. In the summary, I'll give you, it'll show you what area is being reduced, but it was not the full $24 million that was really proposed in the executive budget. And lastly, one of the major points that we discussed, and I think the legislature passed a resolution of support for, was the internet sales tax conformity that was not supported in the final budget. So purchasing online will continue to be marginally hit with sales tax, so that was not moved forward. Again, I have the link to the NYSAC summaries document. I will forward that all. I think I meant to do it earlier. I didn't, but I'll forward it out to you. And as we develop this a little bit more, I will tell you one thing that wasn't on here was the Dormitory Authority was approved to do financing for the Raise the Age facilities, the specialized secure detention facilities. May not be relevant to us, but relevant to some of our neighbors that may end up enacting or expanding current facilities or building facilities. So,
thanks very much, Jason. Anna?
One question about the STAR.
Mm-hmm.
That the requirement is that it's only online or it's going to become only online, right?
I'm not 100% sure on it. I think it's only online, but it's now an extra step in the process.
Right.
So they have to, you know, they've now added another step to getting to do the income verification.
Has Jay talked about a process about providing that in-house support where people can come in and do it there or we? Because that's just such an extreme.
I think once the state figures things out, you know, they're pretty proactive in the office, but I can always have them brief Gio about it when it comes time to do that. I know he has recognized that it is now an additional burden on his office to make sure that the education's out there, and that folks can apply, and they don't miss a year. Anymore.
Like they needed something else to do.
Yeah, and just a few thousand more letters he has to send out.
Yeah, okay.
Is this the requirement that you sign away your privacy to the state so that they can access your 1040 and see what your adjusted gross income?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Because if that's the case, then, yeah, it's an additional step up front. But after that, it's easier. You don't have to do anything. You just automatically every year look at what your income is. And if you qualify, you qualify. So maybe it's not as bad as you think it is.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
Mike Lane?
Many elderly don't file 1040s. And they have to submit an itemized list of their expenses and income.
Oh, wow. Dan?
Jason, I haven't had time to look at the budget at all yet. Do you know if there's any change in the STOA funding, the transportation reimbursement to local transportation?
I don't know the answer to that, but I can look it up.
Thank you.
Yep.
Did you happen to know it's community college funding? Yeah. I'm sorry, yeah. We're putting you on the spot.
Yes. The community college funding was reduced, not the $24 million that was originally proposed, but it was reduced by $7.6 million statewide. There is a chart in the summary I'll send you that tells you the different areas of that community college funding that it was reduced, but it was reduced. I have one. Any more on the budget? I was going to just give you one other update. Over this past few months, we have had been in discussions with the Department of Transportation. Our visit to the state that Martha was able to organize with some of our representatives with the DOT, as well as folks on the second floor in the executive chambers, about moving along the relocation of the DOT facility on the waterfront, has been nibbled on, and as the DOT is beginning now, has done some preliminary review of the location up at the airport, and I would say it's been a very favorable review. It's moved, I would say, quicker than I would expect. From a DOT perspective, and it looks like they're continuing to have discussions. Mike Hall's been sending us updates regularly, and now that the budget is passed, I know Martha's been constantly speaking to our reps on the second floor. So hopefully more good news to come in the future, where we might be talking about selling the piece of property and seeing them vacate their property on the waterfront and moving up by the airport. So.
And we're going to renew the push on the airport grant, too, with our delegation. Any other questions for Jason? Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Jonathan Wood, County Attorney.
I figure Frank is here because he wants to hear me say no report. but I'm not going to do that because Martha asked me to to give an
Jonathan, I was really hoping for consistency.
Right. Me too, but it's not working out that way.
Got to come back next time, Frank.
So Martha has asked me to give a
to the microphone, John.
Sure. Because of some recent communications, the chair has asked me to give an explanation of the New York State Division of Human Rights and how the complaint process works and how counties fit in, and in particular how our county fits in. So I actually took some notes, but I'll try to give a brief explanation. First of all, I should tell you a little bit about my background in it. I've been in charge of that aspect of our human rights department on two occasions, but I actually know a lot more about it from actually being a participant in the process, because we have, over the years, human rights claims against the county. We don't have a lot if we get like one a year maybe, but I've been doing it for 25 years. So mostly what I know is I know from being part of the process. So I'm going to kind of explain from beginning to end how their process works and then how counties fit in and how our county could fit in. So there's the state human rights law, and it's pretty comprehensive, and it prohibits discrimination based on a whole bunch of different areas, including race, creed, color, age, disability. Significantly in recent years, they've added sexual orientation and gender identity. They don't actually have a section gender identity, but they consider it part of sex. So the current New York State human rights law protects gender identity, as well as sexual orientation, and those are fairly new. So what happens if somebody wants to make a complaint, feels that they're discriminated against? The way it currently works is they fill out a detailed complaint form, which is online at the New York State Human Rights website. And there's actually more than one form. It depends on what sort of discrimination. For example, there's a different form for employment than if you're complaining about housing. And they're fairly detailed forms. It asks you, about yourself, why you feel you're discriminated against, how you're treated differently from other people. And so you fill that out, and then you give that to the New York State Division of Human Rights office, which you can either deliver in person, send by mail, or send by email. After that, they have an intake process where one of their employees will basically speak to the person, and they have a sort of formal intake process, but they're trying to make sure, one, that is a legitimate human rights claim, two, that they have jurisdiction, and three, that it's timely. But those things, so they have a set series of training on the people, and they go through it to do basically an intake process with people who want to file a complaint. If the complaint meets those requirements, they then send the complaint to the respondent or the, which is more often than not an employer in most cases. Sometimes it's a housing person, but more often than not it's an employer. And then the employer or the respondent has an opportunity to answer. And after the answer, the complainant has an opportunity to do a rebuttal, in other words, to respond to the answer. That leads to an investigation stage of the process in which they will assign an investigator, and that investigator will investigate in order to determine whether there is probable cause to believe that discrimination took place. How they've done that has actually changed over the years. There was a time where they would come to your offices, like they would come to the county and interview people here. Then there was a time where they did it by phone. There was a brief period of time when Elliot Spitzer was governor where they did no investigation at all. That I still can't understand or whatever, but that's what happened. But in recent years, what they've done is ask the people who they feel might have evidence relevant to come to their office, their local office. In our case, the local office is in Binghamton. So they will contact both the respondent as well as the claimant and say, we would like such and such people to come to our office in Binghamton at such and such a date, at such and such a time. And I can tell you it's not the most pleasant experience driving to Binghamton and sitting in an office and then driving back. And usually they may want a group of people. They may say, we want to talk to these four or five people. And it's for both sides. It's not just for the respondent. It's for the petition, for the complainant as well. And what will generally happen is that the person who's doing the investigation is usually pretty well prepared. They have a series of questions that they want to ask each side, both the claimant and the respondent. And maybe, like, to give an example, I'll give, like, for example, the last case that we had, or part of it. So we had a woman who was claiming that she was discriminated against on the basis of her sex because she was given a more discipline for being late to work than a similarly situated a male employee. And so she presents evidence on that, including her statements and whatever written. And then it becomes incumbent on the employer, if we wish to avoid a finding that that there was probable cause, to come forward with a legitimate non-discriminatory reason. So in this case, we, you know, or that is simply not true. So in this case, for example, the situation was, and their finding is that the woman had been tardy or late 11 times, and the supposedly similar situated male had been late only 2 times, and that was a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, so they found no probable cause. And fortunately, in the years I've done it, we've either always had no probable cause or a few that have gone to hearing. We haven't lost one, at least to date. But in the event they did find there was, so they found no probable cause, and in the event they find no probable cause, that really ends the complaint there. In the event they find probable cause, that means that the claimant is entitled to a hearing. The hearing part is important because they do several things. One, they provide an attorney for the claimant. They need to make a record. So they have a stenographer, a way of making a record, to make a stenographic transcript, and they provide an administrative law judge. So basically, if you've ever done a case where you have to provide two attorneys and a stenographer transcript, it's a fairly expensive process. And the reason the state has, unlike any municipality or county, Because they do this for 56 counties, they have a staff of attorneys, and they have a staff of administrative law judges, and they have a staff of people who do stenographic work, so that they can basically provide this service, which realistically, you know, one or two counties couldn't provide. But they are able to provide this service, including a lawyer, an ALJ, who is attorney, who's trained, as well as stenographic services. So then they'll have a hearing in the event they file a cause. And it'll be pretty much a hearing like, you know, you would expect. There's testimony, there's documentation, and then they'll make a determination, which is really a recommendation, which is basically whether the person established their case or whether there is the person did not establish their case. In the event that they believe the claimant established the case, and again, the ALJ makes a recommendation to the commissioner, but they have the power to give orders to an employer, for example, to stop doing something or to do something. They have the power to give damages to the claimant for whatever damages. And they also have the power to give civil penalties, which, depending on different circumstances, but can be significant, either $50,000 or up to $100,000 in some certain circumstances. Fortunately, we've never been in that situation on the wrong side of that, but they have significant powers to present, you know, to penalize those who they determine violated somebody's human rights. They also have the power to, both legally and financially, to enforce whatever orders they have. They have an enforcement division which can go to court, which can give orders to people, you know, you must comply, you must hire this person, you must pay this person the damages, et cetera. So that's pretty much how the state system works. How counties fit in, I'll try. First of all, there are, I know two and there may be three counties that do probable cause determinations. And they do that pursuant to a memorandum of understanding with the state. I know Nassau and Suffolk have that. I think there's a city, maybe Yonkers, but it's only some large downstate municipalities. And what they do is that they do a probable cause recommendation, which means they do the initial intake as well as the initial investigation and make a recommendation as to probable cause. This has advantages and disadvantages. The major disadvantage is, as we know from when we did it, and maybe it's different now, but you pay for it. The state doesn't give you any money for it, so it costs money. In my mind, having done these many, the major advantage of it is that it's local. You don't have to get everybody up and go to Binghamton or whatever, and that's a convenience for both sides. So there's an advantage to it, but at a cost. So the question is, so why are there so few counties that do that? And the reason is that the state, at this position of the state, and it's been this position of the state for many years now, is that they believe that the amount of training and oversight they have to put in to for have municipalities or counties do that is significant. And it only makes sense if the counties are large enough and have enough complaints where it makes sense to do that. So, for example, Nassau and Suffolk, they have a population of over 1 million people. They have a lot of claims. The state feels that it makes sense for them to train people there and supervise them. But for smaller counties like us, it doesn't make sense to them to do that. Now, as you know, in the past, I think 2008 was the last time we had an agreement. They had a different position. They were willing to work with smaller counties, but that's really not the position now, and it's not realistic that it's going to change in the immediate future. Now I kind of want to talk about what Tompkins County is and some of the it does and some of the issues that have arisen.
Jonathan, this is really, really interesting, and I've never heard all this before. So are there any questions first on what you've said so far? Anne and then Deborah.
Just make one addition that I learned, which was very interesting, is that the state has a very complicated database that they use. And so if they have an MOU, they give those counties access to that database, and that's actually part of the complication to that they look for in relationships. And that was something that they shared with me that I don't know if you dug into a bit.
They do have a database which helps keep track of various, you know, what types of claims, what the rate is, that sort of thing. I'm not sure how that, you know. It's helpful for them to know what kind of claims they get, et cetera.
That was a client information.
Okay. Deborah, Leslin, then Henry.
Could you please remind me what happened with the MOU we had once upon a time?
It simply lapsed. I mean, the MOUs were for 1 year period.
Microphone, please.
Yeah, it basically lapsed. The MOUs were for 1 year periods. And the state, I would say, they didn't exactly say at the time we don't want to renew. That what they said is we renew only under conditions which really didn't work. But I think they really just didn't want to renew. So basically it lapsed as the other smaller counties, you know. I mean, there weren't a huge number, but they let them lapse, essentially.
They let them lapse, the state.
The state was the one I think really wasn't interested in continuing.
Leslin, then Henry.
Jonathan, for the counties that have memos, you said the state, they can do up to probable cause determination. And then what?
Okay. So if they determine that there's no probable cause or probable cause, that is a recommendation. It then goes to the state.
Then it goes to the state, and the state picks it up.
So assuming they find that there's no probable cause and that recommendation is adopted, that ends the case just like.
Right.
If they recommend that there is probable cause and that recommendation is adopted, then it goes to the state system with the hearing, et cetera, where they'll be assigned an attorney if they need one, where there'll be an ALJ assigned, an administrative law judge, as well as, you know, a method of keeping a record. So then it just basically goes into the state system like any case. Basically, the county is acting like an investigator for the state.
Okay. And once it goes, let's say there's a probable cause determination and the case gets sent to the state or filed with the state then picks up the costs from there for the administrative law judge and everything else going forward.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
Henry?
Jonathan, for the initial part of filling out the form, the intake process, that all occurs where? Where does that...
So the process of doing the probable cause determination, if that's what you're talking... So. Is that what you mean?
The intake process that you talked about,
That I'm honestly not sure because it may vary from case to case. I mean, and it could also depend on the, you know, I mean, for example, which office the State Division of Human Rights, I assume that most cases, if not all, from here are done in Binghamton.
Right.
Now, whether they may on some occasions just do it on the phone with a person or whether they require they would come in, I'm not sure necessarily. I think if the person couldn't come in, they'd probably let them do it on the phone. But I assume most cases from here, you know, I'm obviously not involved in that part. They would do it in the Binghamton office from here, depending on where the claimant is from.
Okay.
Did you discuss when you spoke with the state about their practice now about building MOU relationships again
with counties. My last conversation with her, she said that they were open to it as long as we could show that the numbers of cases, potential cases we had, were high enough to make the training and all of that worth it. And I was curious if you'd had any further conversation.
Not specifically, but our numbers are definitely wouldn't even be close.
Right, which was...
The numbers, I think, can pretty much mirror the population. And, you know, we don't have a huge population. We don't have a huge number of claims.
So the cost effectiveness is of doing it.
Yeah, I don't think it would be close in their mind.
Thank you. So go on the next part. This
okay.
Is great.
So what happens now in Tompkins County? What do we currently do? So what we currently do when someone comes into our office with a complaint, we have an intake form, which is our own intake form, different from the state, and we have an intake process where one of our persons will interview the person, gather documentation, review what we feel is the relevant law, and help that person draft a complaint, which would then be sent to the state. So an issue which has arisen, which you probably saw in a recent email, is that the state has indicated that they would prefer that we not do that. Now, what they want us to do is just direct the person to their website, to their process, and to follow their process. Now, understand this. The state understands this, too. They have no power to direct us to do anything, and we can do whatever we feel is the right thing. So, you know, obviously, up till this point, we felt that that's the right thing, that that's beneficial to the process and to the claimant. The state issue with that is a couple things. One is they do their own intake, and they feel like, so you have two intakes, like one intake at the county and then a separate intake at the state. So it's two intakes. Second, they feel that some people that come through to the state after going to the county are confused about the process. They feel, well, didn't I already do this kind of thing? And it creates some level of confusion for them. And third, that because the training of the people is somewhat different, that the result they believe might be somewhat different. And, for example, they may look at a complaint that we do and say, well, in our intake process, this or that claim might have been weeded out. So they prefer that we not do that. You know, obviously we wouldn't do that or been doing that if we didn't feel it was helpful to the process. And to be honest, I haven't discussed it with the staff. It's a new issue to me. And I have to kind of think about it, about what is best. But that's the issue that has been raised. And I think you got an email about it, and I'm just trying to clarify what the issue is. Haven't made any decisions or anything on it, but that's what the state has expressed as their concern, and that's what we do. So that's the other thing. I do want to say a little bit about our county local law, because you've seen some references to that. So we have a county sexual or non-discrimination law. I think in 1991 we first adopted it, and it covered just sexual orientation. And the reason why it was done is because the state law didn't cover sexual orientation at that time. Now it does. I wasn't here at that time, so that predates me. Then in 2004, we extended our law to cover gender identity and expression. I was here at that time. I was active in that. And, of course, we did that because the state law didn't cover gender identity and expression at that time. Now it does. Our law is a little different than the state law. In fact, it's kind of significantly different. What our law really does is it declares those things are illegal, and it allows for us to do an investigation, probable cause, a fact-finding, and conciliation, But what it really does, because we don't have any penalties and we don't have a process like attorneys or an ALJ or anything like that, administrative law judge, it basically provides claimants with an opportunity to bring an action in court because it now has a law which says you can't do that. You can't discriminate on those things. It's not a comprehensive process like the state has, but of course the state didn't cover those things at the time. So, I mean, our theory was that this would prevent people from being discriminated on those things and would give them a cause of action in court for discrimination where they could proceed and get damages. And it also provide a process where we can do an investigation and we can make findings and try to conciliate. So that's what our law is and does. Almost anything which falls under our law now falls into the state law, which wasn't the case when they were adopted. So that's kind of my explanation. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I hope that's helpful in understanding it.
Yeah. Deborah?
So I want to be sure I understand this. The state law is caught up with our law in terms of reaching allegations of discrimination on the basis of sexual identity and gender. And
yes. Now, they specifically added language for sexual orientation, and the thing on sexual identity stuff is basically they've interpreted their law, which prohibited discrimination based on sex, as covering those things.
All right. So, meanwhile, the state law is now pretty much as broad as our law, with the exception of creating this independent cause of action that someone can bring, I assume, at their own expense.
Well, the state law does that, too.
Okay.
So you have that choice. I think most people choose to use the state system because it's better than just bringing a lawsuit.
So we have these two laws that basically cover the same thing. And then we have the state that says they no longer want us to do intake for their law.
Right. Well, yeah, pretty much, yes.
So I guess my question, which is probably not going to be terribly popular, is why do we have an Office of Human Rights in Tompkins County?
Well, can I say one thing to begin with is complaints is just one aspect of a Department of Human Rights.
Okay, so
we focus a lot on that thing, but that's not the only thing a Department of Human Rights can do or a commission does.
What else do they do?
Well, I mean, community education and programs. I mean, you know, that's one thing we're sort of exploring is more things they can do, but community education, teaching people about human rights, educational programs and that sort of thing. But for many years when we were doing probable cause determinations, the focus of the department was on that, and we had actually two investigators and the head of the department spent significant time on that.
Anna, and then Henry?
I think in addition to what he's saying, actually, historically, one of the most useful things that I think OHR did was mediation, which is not what he's speaking about, and I think that they did it very effectively. So that's pretty big as a part of a conversation, then education, then outreach, and handling everything with respect to OHR within, they could do within the established, within the government and within the community. So that would be our outreach arm, but mediation is a big piece that we did previously that was important.
Do we do it anymore?
It has not been done in the last couple of years. That is not something. It was a focus on getting the local law and a focus on some of those conversations of the MOU, but the real focus of the office has been whether or not they would trying to get their energy to get a local law that would replicate what the state has.
or duplicate what the state has.
Yeah. The term is conciliation that they use in the human rights context.
Conciliation.
They still have the authority to do that.
Conciliation.
Right, and we can do conciliation anyway on the state claims, whatever, and have been able to actually, since I've been there, been able to do that in one or two cases. But it hasn't really been an emphasis of the office.
Henry?
So under all county law, they have a right to go to court and sue and collect damages?
Interestingly, the law doesn't specifically say damages, but if you violate the law and somebody and you cause me damage, then I would be entitled to sue for damages, yes.
Do you know how many cases people are advised to go through our county system, or are they advised to go use the state system?
I don't know anybody that has brought an action under our
County law,
certainly in recent years, and it would seem a better approach for most people, I think, to use the state system, because they provided an attorney, that there's they have all the powers of a basically of a court. So it's probably a better avenue. I mean, I don't advise people on making claims, but it seems that that's probably a better avenue for a person who feels they're been discriminated against.
They haven't slept down to Binghamton.
Right.
So if they go and sue here under our law, they have to pay all the costs.
Right. There's no, I mean, obviously they may be able to find an attorney who may be one to represent them, or, but there is no provision for paying. We don't provide an attorney. We don't provide an administrative law. So it's up to them, basically.
Okay. Let's see, Leslin and Amanda. Not Amanda. Yes, Leslin. Okay.
So, Deborah, that's an interesting question. And I would venture to say that there's been a lot that this office has been responsible for within the community, and there's a level of, or was a level of trust and comfort in the community to know that things didn't just get lost in a black hole when it got sent to
Albany
or Binghamton or New York City. Because at one point, all the state, I think, sexual harassment cases were going to New York City. At any rate, the education component was huge, and really doing a lot of work to help employers and landlords and whomever else avoid getting themselves into pickle with understanding what the laws are. I think there's still, when the office was restructured, I think there's a big part of it as well. So that has been good. And even the education with the children and then the schools in understanding universal human rights. So there was a lot of that. That the office, so there's a significant benefit that the office has paid for people in the community. And if not for anything, just knowing that there's a local place you can go to that will help you navigate the state system. That has been very important. Jonathan, I have a question for you. If we decided, or if we said, yes, we're going to have a law that matches what the state has, it doesn't seem like it makes sense since there's already an existing state law. But if we did, as we had been exploring locally, then we are then taking on the responsibility of doing, mirroring what the state did, like providing the attorney and all of those things, and adjudicating, I don't know how to say it better,
right.
The cases and meeting out the penalty.
Right. I mean, you have the issue of the person being represented by counsel. You have the issue of making a record, a stenographic record. You have the issue of a qualified administrative law judge making a decision, and then you have the issue of enforcing it.
So if we chose to have our own local law that mirrors the state law or more,
make us Tompkins County cutting edge before gender identity made it to the state level. We were doing it, discrimination. If we chose to do that, then all those things you mentioned then becomes our financial responsibility.
Right.
And is there any part of it that we could say, well, no, you're on your own, find your own attorney?
Well, I mean, what we could do and what others is basically say that so you get to the point where there's probable cause that the county or the county could represent you in court or something like that rather than provide, I mean, you know, still obviously an expense or stuff, but less so than providing you with an attorney and an ALJ and a transcript and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there are some, like, human rights laws, local laws, for example, which could provide that the municipality would then provide representation or something like that.
I have a lot more questions, but it's late.
Okay, Anna and Mike Sigler.
Adding to a question that was inspired by Leslin's question, and then this might be half-baked, outside-the-box idea, but would it be possible to create a local law that got us to probable cause and not all the way through, because that cost difference, I mean, I know that's basically mirroring an MOU, rather than the full state law?
Yeah, no, the answer is no, because the state wants to do its own.
I understand. That's why I was trying to figure out if, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't count for anything. I mean, you can do it, but then you'd be
But
left.
The state would just repeat it.
Right, exactly.
So you're putting the parties through two processes.
Right. Okay. Which is what I thought. I just wanted to work it through.
Mike Sigler?
So you're saying that the county would pay for this person's attorney? So we would
Well,
pay
not,
for one representation against another citizen who's not been convicted of anything?
Yeah, I'm not recommending it. I mean, that's part of the issue in that, you know. So when you're doing probable cause determinations, for example, you really need to be objective because there's two sides, and both of which are Tompkins County residents or businesses. So it does present an issue, you know, obviously it's only if there's that determination, but, yeah, that would then put you against another county entity. So
yeah, I'm
like not recommending that. I'm just saying that, you know, I mean, when the state enforces one of their orders, they're in essence enforcing an order against somebody who's in their state, right?
Just through a DA.
But I'm not, but it's them, it's not us.
I would think it would go through the Attorney General and there would be somebody kind of signing off on that, right?
Right. The point is, and Leslin's question gets to, is after you get to the point of saying there's probable cause, you really need to have some adjudicatory process which is fair to both sides and has professional determination. And that's what the state does, and that's what's really difficult for us, any small municipality, to do.
Okay. I'm pretty sure this won't be the last time we talk about it, but this has really been very helpful, Jonathan. And I thank you for taking the time, and I really appreciate it. Anything else? All set? Great. Rick Snyder, Finance Director.
And I have no report for tonight.
You took Jonathan.
Fill Jonathan's shoes.
Jonathan's line. Okay. Very good. We've done the consent agenda, so we go to committees. Budget, Capital, and Personnel. Mike Lane, Chair.
We will be meeting. We had a brief meeting right before this legislature meeting. We didn't take any action except to hear from our county administrator in a joint meeting with the Government Operations Committee regarding his plans to begin the interview process and the advertising for a deputy county administrator. And our next regular meeting will be on April 10th at 4 o'clock here, rather in the old jail.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions for Mike? Thanks very much. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Leslie McBean-Claiborne, Chair.
Thank you. I am going to defer to Anna Kellis, Vice Chair of the Committee, for the report.
Okay. We've had a whole bunch of conversations, and Jason was there as well. So if I miss anything, please, Jason, do chime in, because actually one of the pieces that was on the agenda was your report. So I might actually let you summarize the report that you gave. The one thing, though, that did happen that I think is important is last year, the LGBTQIA toolkit, which is a toolkit that was used to outline proper procedures within law enforcement, within the jail, within, you know, connections with, interactions with the LGBTQIA community to sort of help sensitivity and understanding. That toolkit has been reviewed again by the WDIC, and one of the conversations that came out of that was reaching out to law enforcement and having an open dialogue about the languaging in the toolkit, what works, what didn't work, what it outlined as procedure that was or was not the actual procedure. So the toolkit itself has been converted to microfiche, and it has been given out to law enforcement to give input and thoughts about what procedures are actually in place, support, thoughts of training. It's actually a really productive way to create a conversation that I think is very positive movement forward. Another thing that happened is that members of a subcommittee went to the jail to take a tour so that they could understand the facility. As all of you guys have seen, there are some major complications with the jail, difficulty, and it's very hard for people to talk about what law enforcement in the jail should or shouldn't do without understanding the physical limitations that they have. So they did a report back on that, and that, in a nutshell, is kind of part of the conversation that was had. And I'm going to leave it up to Jason to talk about the report out that he gave to WDIC.
May I just very quickly, before Jason goes, says that that toolkit was developed by the staff in the Office of Human Rights.
Absolutely.
Briefly, I was asked several... Megan.
Yeah, I just said thank you both.
I apologize. Yeah. I was asked briefly to look into several areas surrounding. One was with respect to, can we ask vendors that we contract with what type of diversity and inclusion policies they have? Did some research with respect to how we manage our contracts. The short answer is yes, we can ask questions, and yes, we can collect that data, similar to how we do to now with respect to the living wage question. We are working on digitizing our entire contract management system, which will make it easier to ask questions and collect information, whether it's about living wage or whether it's about diversity inclusion policies that our vendors may have or may participate in. So that was kind of, yes, it can happen, and hopefully by the end of the year, our contract management system will be fully implemented, and it'll be easier to collect it digitally. Second question was about quarterly and annual reporting with respect to the employee workforce and demographics. We provided several different types of quarterly and annual reports, got some feedback on them, and we'll come back if not in April, most likely May, with some suggestion based on those suggestions as to what type of reports the committee would like to see on a regular basis. And then the last was from the prior meeting, I believe in February, Lesnar had asked about existing practices within departments and what were they doing to practice best practices with respect to inclusion and diversity. How are we continuing to promote that? HHS cabinet got together, kind of talked about that, and came up with a series of questions about what's going on in the existing departments. How can we gather that information and then share that information across departments in terms of, hey, here's what we're doing internally across, you know, spectrum of all the departments. So we're kind of developing that a little bit further, and then developing on how to way to best collect the information, and then ultimately share it within the organization. And that would be both internal and external activities, both inside, meaning inside the department, and also engagement with the community.
And I would add the one barrier that we need to make sure that we're really conscientious of is that
we don't explore information and share information such that individual people can be identified. And those are the barriers, because some of the numbers could be very small. So figuring out the logistics of that are very important and will be the next steps.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything else from WDIC?
We meet next 2 weeks from now?
Oh boy. 2 or 3 weeks, I think.
Three weeks.
From
now. The fourth Wednesday, thank you, the 25th of April at 3:30 in the Old Jail Conference Room. Hopefully what we will have on that agenda is some folks from the City of Ithaca who brought sort of a diversity and inclusion toolkit parts of the CTAP agreement, coming to share with us about that, to see what, if anything, we want to do as a county, but at least to share the information so that we have it. So that will be one of our agenda items. There you go, Kathy. That's the agenda. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Team report. For the Housing Committee, we have not met since the last legislature meeting. Our next meeting is April 16th in this room at 3 o'clock. I just want to say one thing. We, a few of us had a meeting to continue to pursue this question of, can the county money be spent for affordable housing or in any way? And it seems so, it seems like if we don't have the state law enabling us, allowing us to do it, we're just going to have to keep, we're going to burn up Jonathan's time. I mean, we're going to have to do all sorts of double backflips to try to figure out what might fit. So it's important that we, as whatever it is that we develop in this area, I think it's worth trying to get that state law passed. It doesn't cost the state anything. I think it should not be a tremendously heavy lift. Now that the budget is over, I think we have raised it with every member of our delegation that we've met with. So I think it's basically a Barbara Lifton and Tom O'Mara thing. And so I would like to go to sort of raise that again with them, talk about it with NYSAC, strategize kind of what they see as the most profitable way, the most efficient way to go about this. Remember, they did pass a resolution asking the state to allow Tompkins County, as a home rule measure, allow Tompkins County to do this. And again, it doesn't require us or anybody else to spend any money on affordable housing. It just allows us to, if we come to that as a decision on our own. So I will follow that. We already did pass a resolution asking NYSAC to ask the state or asking, I think the resolution was asking that the state do it. I'll go back and make sure I've got that, and we'll take it from there. So any questions? Mike?
Martha, and I don't know whether your committee has talked about it or not, but we got an email from Cornell University about what they're planning to involve the public on East Hill development that they're planning. I think there's three different opportunities to for them to review input and to take input on that. And I think that's important. If we can attend some of those, it's a good idea.
The East Hill Village development, they're calling it. So next week, Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, all the meetings are at the space at Green Star. I have down here that they all start at 6, kind of 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock. I think they're slightly different agendas for each one. But so if people are interested. And last time, they're having it at the space, even though, it's nowhere near East Hill Plaza. But last time they had something like 150 people come, and they realized they did not have a room big enough up at the Cornell office building up there. So thanks for mentioning that, Mike.
Yeah.
Henry?
Isn't also a target, a focus group that's meeting, I believe, on the Tuesday? Or
right. We were, a few of us maybe, I don't know who was asked, but yeah, Tuesday at 2:30. So I'm not sure if that, I can't remember if that's just local elected officials or who.
Yeah, I think it's local elected officials.
I think they actually wanted to not restrict it, but only invite a handful of us due to the fact that they wanted to keep it a small group.
Right.
People that, like, for example, that's in my district, and I think possibly Martha was invited
as well.
I'm
invited to that. Yeah. Now you've blown it, Henry. Thanks. just going to make everybody else feel bad. I'm sure everybody is, you know, I mean, the whole purpose of the three public meetings is to get lots and lots of public comments. So, thanks. Anything else? Any other questions? Okay, thanks very much. Public Safety Committee. Henry, Vice Chair?
Yes, Public Safety has not met since the last meeting, though we meet tomorrow at 3 o'clock here. OAR is going to make a presentation, and the sheriff's resolution on the SRO has been removed from the agenda. And that's really about it.
Okay, any questions for Henry? Thanks very much. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
We have not had an HHS meeting since the March 20th legislative meeting. Our next Health and Human Services meeting will take place Monday, April 9th at 4 p.m. We will cover the topic of 211 with John Mazzella and Kathy Schlatter that will be presenting. They're going to talk about the major changes that we're going to see in 2018. They're adding a text option. They're also going to add features that will assist with transportation for people that currently are recipients of Medicaid.
Great. Terrific. Any questions for Shauna?
I think Shauna forgot that we met this afternoon. That counts.
So
we get it. You tired.
I think it's kind of late, and I know I've seen some yawns. So everybody's forgiven. So these are the two resolutions that are on here, but that we already passed earlier in the night.
C too.
Yeah. What?
Okay.
But yeah, we did. Yeah. We did them both, right? Okay. All right. Anything else for Shauna? She says, "Thank goodness." All right.
Can you go over in detail?
No. No. Dave McKenna, Facilities and Infrastructure Committee.
F&I has not met since the last ledge meeting. Our next meeting is April 19th at 3 p.m. in these chambers. That's my report.
Any questions? Ann.
I just wanted to add that I did get a hold of my call at the airport, and I'll be attending a meeting on Thursday at noon regarding an update on the geothermal project.
On what?
Geothermal.
Oh, okay. Great. All right. Anything else? Thank you, Dave. Mm-hmm. Transportation Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
We were scheduled to meet on Friday. We were planning to have a meeting devoted to TCAT and the discussions about possible capital in the future for that. Unfortunately, TCAT called and said they can't make it, so we're not going to have the meeting on Friday.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Mike? Thank you very much. That's pretty... There you go. All right. That's done. Planning PDEC, Anna Kellis, Chair.
We have Government Operations.
What? I'm sorry. GO, Dan Klein, Chair.
Our next meeting is in 2 days, Thursday, April 5th, 9:30. Two items that we'll be working on. One is initial discussion about redoing our website in some form or another. And the other is the beginning of the foreclosure process. This is something that goes through GO every year. There are currently 21 parcels that are being foreclosed upon, but typically that goes down to two or one or sometimes zero. It's a long process, and we kind of get updated as it goes along. Rick Snyder is heavily involved in this process and will tell us a lot, and the planning department's also involved.
Thank you, Dan. Henry?
Didn't you have a meeting today?
Yep.
Okay.
Bazinga. That was a long time ago.
It's already been reported on by the budget. No action was taken.
Dan, did I've been hearing a lot about assessments. Do you have any kind of general report from Jay Franklin about what's going on this year?
Well, after last month when we got his his annual report, I haven't heard a word, actually.
You mean from... from?
Well, my towns didn't get reassessed, so I haven't heard.
No.
And I have not heard anything from Jay either.
This year, just, yes. Henry and then Deborah? Henry and then Deborah, right?
Yes. The city of Ithaca did get reassessed.
Over and over again.
And we've had there's been lots of listserv information. Yeah. Jay Franklin's coming to the South Hill Civic Association meeting on Saturday morning to answer questions, and I've been emailing people and telling them that the Jay's office is open, but they also they raised the property values, the land values, and then by like 10,000 or doubling it, and that caused a lot of people to say, well, how do you know my land went up in value? Mm-hmm. And so I got the explanation from him, but again, it was a hot topic in my district.
Yeah, no doubt.
Deborah, did you have your hand up?
I just wanted to say that people in the town of Lansing are also quite exercised about the results of this latest assessment, so be prepared.
Shauna?
I will say that I have also heard complaints from Northeast residents. Typically, they're complaining about $15,000 to $20,000 increase, and then I told them that I had a $30,000 increase and did not receive the county discount. And so that calms them down a bit.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, now they think there's a county discount. All right. Anna, did you have your hand up?
Yeah.
The two-part application.
Well, and one of the main questions that I got that I actually didn't know about, which is the first time that I've seen the land and the property separated out, and one constituent said that the combination of the two of them, his went up $60,000, which, like, kind of blew my mind a little bit, and I didn't understand. I didn't have an answer yet. I was going to speak to Jay, but if you've already spoken to him, if you guys know the answer to why that was split, it's a state mandate, isn't
it? Yeah, we really didn't talk about it being split. We just talked about the value going up, and he said that it was that no one was selling just land in the area, so there's no comparables. He just looked at it, and that you just have to look at the overall number, and that's it.
But they said something about typically one would go up, the other would go, they would counter each other, right? So that the overall, and but in some cases they didn't, and so that was one thing that I'm trying to understand, and the other was whether or not this was a mandate that came from state.
I don't know if it was a mandate that came from state. I know that he said again to look at the numbers combined and not to really separate them. They just were assessing it, and they just bumped up some of the land values and took down some of the property values or whatever, just to make it set. But again, because somebody talked about why in the world is the land value going up,
right?
And he said, well, just look at the numbers combined.
So Dave and then Jason.
Okay, I talked to Irene Keel about a similar subject for Newfield, although the amount that it was raised was a lot less. And what she told me was it was on the prime acre. Other acreage of the property, or basically prime acre of the property where you would build your house. And that particular piece of property went up, that 1 acre would go up, in our case, $5,000. Okay. The rest of the property, they said, there was based at $1,500 an acre.
So, but if you're in the city, there's...
The city is different.
All,
I mean, yeah. Every place that you go is going to be different. But,
right. Okay.
But basically was raised a raise in value of the prime acre of the priest property. And I don't know if it was a state mandate or not. I didn't ask her that.
Jason and then Dan?
Generally speaking, assessments are broken into two categories, the land value and the structure value. So the fact that there's two values is the combined taxable assessed value. That's nothing that's new in the process. Just something to keep in mind as assessments are reviewed and increased or decreased. Assessments, you're at 100% full market value, so assessments should reflect the fair market value of that property, and that's determined through property sales of similar like properties. So if you have a four four-bedroom home, 2,000 square foot, with a size, acreage lot. It's going to, the assessed value should be representative of similar type properties and similar type makes and models and what those are being sold for. Obviously, there's a grievance process that you have the ability to grieve that, both informally and formally, as based on property values and other property sales. And I know Jay, their office, is very good about sitting down, showing the comparative data of this is how the property was determined, and sometimes they are wrong, and they'll work with you in terms of if they feel the assessment is too high, they will lower it based on some property sales.
Dan and then Mike Sigler.
One small thing that you can tell your constituents that I do is that just because your assessment went up, say, 10%, it does not mean your taxes are going to go up 10%. It's based on the tax rate, the tax levy, and your assessment. It's pretty complicated, but you can at least tell them that little bit. It doesn't mean that it's going up the same amount that your assessment went up.
Mike and then Leslie.
So, Jason, if somebody were to move in from, like, say, Batavia or something, their purchase price would really set the market for that home.
It could. The only thing that throws a wrench in things is when your appraisal is less than your purchase price. Mm-hmm. And then you get caught in a little bit of a pickle because you were competing for that property with other bidders. And then we have a little bit of an oops moment, and then we try to backtrack. But, yes, that is true. So, if the only thing that helps me with is if my appraisal is lower than my purchase price, I can go to Jay and say, see, you can't increase the value of my home that much because I can't sell it for that much again. So, but yes, thank you, Mike.
That sounds like the county discount. I didn't mean that. That was a joke. Leslie?
Well, Dan said it much more eloquently than I would have. I was about to say that it's a mess. I.e., it's complicated. I'm not going to stop there.
You're never going to live that down.
That's what I was going to say. This, it doesn't mean that your taxes go up. So thank you for sharing that.
It makes you worry about that. But, yeah, right, exactly. Absolutely. When people think of it, okay, we got all this construction going on, well, that adds to the tax base. And if, as long as the budget itself, as long as the spending is, let's say, is constant, if there's more construction, your taxes can go down even if your assessment goes up. So Dan, do you have any idea, do you think the housing trust that we, the INHS does, where they literally take the land value out of the value of the house, do you think that has anything to do with, if this is new?
That was my question.
I know what Jason says, not actually new, but if they are describing it differently, I wonder if...
I'm not aware of this situation. I'm not really the guy to ask.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't believe it's new. I think we've always gotten those two numbers. But, again, they also looked at the city of Ithaca with a closer view this year. That he said that, and he said, and prices are going up. And so this is a demand of living in the city of Ithaca. So your assessment's going to go up.
Well, and I don't think the city was the only place that went up. So would people be interested in if Jay would do a presentation at, say, the next Ledge meeting? Because we all have those Board of Assessment reviews in May. Would that be a good thing? Dan, do you want to ask him, or do you want me to?
Why don't you ask him, Mark?
Sure. Okay. Thank you very much. Anything else for Dan, for Gio? Thanks very much, Dan. PDIC, Anna Kellis, Chair.
So we've had two meetings since Monday at 3 o'clock. But the main one, of course, we had two big presentations. One was from the city-town. Nick Goldsmith presented on the Green Business Plan, which I highly recommend people checking out if they want to get a sense of what the city and town is doing, because I think that it'll certainly affect a lot of the conversations that we're having about the county greenhouse gas emissions, and it's kind of awesome. So that's my scientific evaluation, of course, of the measure. But essentially, they've established a point system for developments And the conversation they're having is whether or not to consider this as a requirement for developers. And they have two paths that they can go through. One is the point system, or one is a third-party assessment like LEED, for example. That's one of them. One of the things that they pointed out that was really important is that the point system, which would reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, which was the goal of the point system, there are ways to get all of the numbers that you need, which is a minimum of six, and not increase the actual price of the development. So there were some of them that are very cost-effective, some of them that can reduce the price of it. And I think that that was probably one of the most important distinctions. The other thing that they did mention was an idea within this plan for the IDA specifically that would help us take clear steps to reach the District 2030, which we became. The city became a District 2030, Architect 2030, as some people, that is the official name. And the idea is that the IDA would set a goal from now until 2025 that all developments going through would need to reach the 2025 goals for greenhouse gas emissions. And applying after that, they would need to reach the 2030 goal, which is a net zero development, which is huge. So that's a quick summary. The other presentation was from TCAT, and they talked about transportation-oriented development, I think is the name of it. And the idea, in a nutshell, is that if you bring TCAT in much earlier in the conversation of development, then developments can be designed to be part of the effective and efficient transportation system instead of counter to it, because there are very clear patternings, movements of transportation that can decrease or increase the time it takes them to get through a route significantly. And that is very often what happens when developers don't speak early on with transportation. So it was a good conversation. The idea is that we'll bring transportation, TCAT in more frequently so that we can have those conversations about how do we support them and how do we get a collaboration with them and other agencies and development within the county. So I think I have one resolution left out of the three. Oh, and
any questions for Anna on the report? Okay. Go ahead with you.
Okay, PDAC is 4 weeks from now, 4 Mondays from now. It's the last Monday of the month, if anybody has the date off the top of their heads. 3 p.m. here in the chambers. And the last resolution is
packet page 24G.
G, amendment of the 2018 Tompkins County budget to reflect appropriations of 2018-2019 budget for the Ithaca-Tompkins County Transportation Council, and authorization to implement the amendment, and this is ID 7659. I'd like to move that.
Seconded by Dave. Any questions, any conversation, debate? This is the pass-through for the ITCTC budget.
And this was just passed at 5 o'clock today.
What?
We voted in committee.
I know. I asked about it in committee. I asked about it, but I didn't move it up because Fernando wasn't here anyways.
Right.
All right. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you very much.
PDEC meeting's the 23rd.
The 23rd of April. Okay,
23rd at 3 p.m. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Anne. I've got the minutes of March 6th. Anybody want to move it? Deborah moves it. Mike seconds. Any discussion? All in favor, please raise your hand. Any opposed? Minutes of March 20th, 2018. Moved by Mike, seconded by Henry. Discussion, ready to vote. All in favor, please raise your hand. Any opposed? It's both unanimous. Boy, that feels good, doesn't it? Okay, motion to adjourn. Deborah, Henry, all in favor. Thank you very much.